Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out of a smoking gun. Now some of you have lived through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
All right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Here until 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. I am your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. here till 5. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews with Steve and Eric, and that's just coming up in just a couple of minutes. So there you go. Lots of movies to review, and Eric will stick around. We'll talk about the box office as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And by the way, last night the Emmys were handed out, so we're going to go through that list of winners and surprises. We got some award show scandals to talk about, and the Emmys in general. We'll get into that as well. Yeah, and there's a new Rambo movie, so we might talk a little bit more about the Rambo series here on 720 WGN. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Anytime you want to jump in here, you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And also, subscribe to our podcast. It's a great way to listen to the show. If you can't, listen live between 1 and 5 a.m. every weekday morning, well, just subscribe to our podcast. It'll be automatically sent to you to your device and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. All right. Let me say hello to my producer, and that's Tom Hush. Tom, how are you, buddy?
Hey, I'm great, Nick. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm all right. Yeah. You had a good weekend?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad, except for, you know, the Cubs.
Oh, man.
Just a tough way to end the weekend.
No, it's terrible. Yeah. Absolutely terrible, man. And Chris Bryant with his, you know, I mean, it couldn't get any worse. You know what I mean? Chris Bryant with the ankle.
This might be rock bottom, at least for this season.
Well, it was just been a... I mean, that's just the worst way to end. They got six games left, but you know, but I mean, to be swept at home by the Cardinals and to have them clinch at Wrigley,
it hurts.
It's horrible. So anyway, well, the less spoken about the Cubs, the better.
True.
So, but hey, there's always next year.
Well, there's big.
But hey, listen, hockey season's coming up, so
that's true.
You know, I'm looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. So I got that to look forward to. I think the Hawks are going to be good this year.
Yeah, I'm feeling positive. Feeling
yeah, me
good.
Too. I mean, yeah, there you go. All right. We are here until 5 a.m. Let's go into the newsroom, and it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. For a Monday, not too shabby, actually.
Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, actually productive, we'll say that. I worked a little bit, so...
Okay.
Wasn't a ton of fun, is what I'm saying, but yeah, it was a good weekend. Good,
okay.
Good productive
well,
weekend.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
We're all here. Boy, rainy yesterday.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Out of nowhere.
Been ridiculous. I was out building an ark. I mean, it was ridiculous. So, anyway. Did you watch the Emmys?
I did watch the Emmys,
yeah.
A lot of fun surprises.
Lots of surprises.
I was shocked.
Yeah.
At how much I was enjoying it, because my mileage varies with award shows. Sometimes it's just so predictable, and
well, you
everybody
know,
wins who you think is going to win. But
I thought they did a nice job with it.
They did a very good job.
You know,
with
we'll talk about the show itself, the broadcast, and we want to hear from you guys at 312-981-7200, and some really big surprises, like in major categories. So it wasn't a surprise what won, you know, best drama. With the, you know, I mean, obviously everybody knew Game of Thrones was going to win it. But stuff leading up to it, man. What a night for Fleabag.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? Thrilled. You know who's going to lose his mind? Feinberg, when we talk to him.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
Yeah.
One of the best comedies I've ever seen.
So, yeah, we'll talk about it. We're going to talk about this morning. And if you guys want to jump in and tell us what you thought of the broadcast and the winners and the losers, we'll go through the list and we'll talk Emmys from the past and all kinds of cool stuff. And then tomorrow we'll get the official wrap up with our good friend Dan Feinberg. And get his take on the Emmys. But we'll talk about it later on. We want to hear from you guys for talk or text or any of that kind of stuff. We'll jump in on the Emmys in a little bit. 312-981-7200. All right, we're going to break. When we come back, Steve and Eric will be here, and it is time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. He tells a joke every Monday morning. We also have the Monday morning movie reviews and some box office to talk about. We're going to play a little catch up when I was not on this past week ago on Monday. So we're going to play a little bit of catch up here. On some of the movies, but we got the new ones to talk about as well. Also, the Emmys were handed out last night. I watched the show. If you guys watched it, we want to hear from you. We've got some award show scandals that we're going to talk about, and things you never knew about the Emmys. And we'll talk about the show and the winners and all the surprises. Lots of surprises last night on the Emmys. So we will get to all of that right here. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text and all that good stuff. Yes. So, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week to discuss the new movies and review the movies. And then Eric sticks around and we do the box office as well. So, let's get these guys on. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Thank you.
And, Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hey, I think this is the first time in a long time the three of us have been on together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think since August, right. Actually. Yeah, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, it feels like it's been a long time. Well, we're here. We're all here. All right, we'll play a little catch-up from last week.
Yeah.
Steve, tell everybody about Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice.
Oh, happily. I just sort of recently rediscovered my childhood love of the music of Linda Ronstadt. I got a couple greatest hit CDs and a deluxe edition of the Trio album or recordings, and then there was a live album that just came out. And then it's perfect that this documentary has come out that traces her life from sort of childhood and singing very popular Mexican songs with her very musical family, and then her years being a diverse recording artist, and sort of how today how she's adjusted to a life without any public singing since Parkinson's disease began impacting her voice several years ago. I think her last concert was like 2009. The film is directed, called The Sound of My Voice, and the film is directed by these two very talented documentary filmmakers. I guess they make features too, but Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, who did either together or separately did like the Oscar-winning The Times of Harvey Milk and The Celluloid Closet. The film frames Ronstadt in a very different light than I think other recent films about singer-songwriters, since she wasn't a songwriter. Instead, her gift, aside from her flawless, versatile voice, was finding the perfect songs to fit her vocal abilities. And often these were lesser-known gems that she and her various collaborators and bandmates would polish and rearrange and send out into the world as perfect pop rock creations. And it goes through her whole career, obviously, starting as a member of a band called the Stone Ponies with the song Different Drum, which was like kind of life-changing for a lot of, especially female singers. And then she quickly moved on as a solo artist, and her first band basically became the Eagles, which is, everybody knows that story, but it's still kind of great to hear it in this. And there's no reason to go through like the list of great songs that she made famous, but thanks to a combination of like archival interviews and more substantial recent interviews with her, she's basically able to sort of narrate her own story, which is I think a real important thing. The documentary explains very clearly why she became one of the biggest female rock acts of all time, and certainly the biggest one through a big chunk of the 70s. And then in an industry that was certainly completely dominated by men, she also helped out a lot of female singers, a lot of like Emmylou Harris, her trio's partner, tells a great story about how she kind of pulled her out from despair after Gram Parsons died and sort of encouraged her to do her own music. The film covers a little bit of her personal life, including her longtime relationship with the musician J.D. Souther, and then, of course, her headline-making romance with California Governor Jerry Brown, but thankfully they don't really linger on that, and they kind of stick to the music. And far more detail is paid to some of the stuff she did after her rock career, including, you know, operatic musical theater with Pirates of Penzance, which they made into a movie, and then she did a standards collection with Nelson Riddle, and like I said, the Trio's album with Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton. She did Spanish language recordings, basically forays into every imaginable musical genre. I think one of the most jaw-dropping moments in the film is when we see her today, and we see her, she's in her early 70s, and she's singing harmony with a pair of family members on some of these Mexican folk songs that she loves, and her voice sounds lovely, and I think it drives home a point that the film makes, which is that she didn't stop singing because she couldn't sing, which is the way it was reported by a lot of people. She stopped singing because it wasn't perfect anymore, and she was a true perfectionist when it came to the presentation of her music, and that point is driven home repeatedly in this film. And without that sort of defining vocal range that she used to have, she wasn't interested in being a part of the conversation anymore. And that's a beautiful decision that she made, and empowering and inspiring and a little sad. I'm not only recommending The Sound of My Voice, I think it's important to sort of see it in a theater featuring the best possible sound system, because if they crank it right, it just sounds amazing in a big theater. The live performances really pop, in particular when you see it that way. So, you know, she was a musical pioneer, a very vocal activist for all manner of human rights, and a damn fine person. And the film kind of captures it all beautifully. So I am definitely recommending it.
Oh, I think it's one of the best movies of the year. It's really, really great. I happen to be a really big Linda Ronstadt fan. I think, as most people are. And this is just all encompassing. It really is. It's complete. It's really well done. You know, the talking heads are great. The people that she's worked with in the past are great, and her story is terrific. And it's told really, really beautifully in this. And like you, Steve, I was under the impression that she can't sing anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty amazing moment in the film. This is a woman who deserves a documentary made about her pioneering female vocalist, and you know, her impact on music is immeasurable. And and this is a really, really great tribute to her. I think everybody should see it, especially if you're a fan of Linda Ronstadt, because this is a great movie. It's a terrific, terrific movie. These guys make good films.
Yeah.
Edstein and Friedman. They make really good movies. And this is only playing in three theaters. It's playing at the Arclight in Chicago. It's playing at the Landmark on Clark and at the Century in Evanston. And I would go out of my way to see it. It is an absolutely terrific film. So, all right. Catching up on last week, Eric, tell us about Hustlers.
Okay. Well, this is based on, I think it was a Vanity Fair article about a true story about a group of strippers who basically sort of turned the tables on the people that they were entertaining. The movie stars Constance Wu as one of these women who basically comes under the tutelage of Jennifer Lopez's sort of more world-weary dancer, if you will. They form a friendship, and, you know, we sort of get, you know, the basic story of what, you know, what strip clubs are and the people that patron them and whatnot, and what the Jennifer Lopez's character basically concocts is the idea that where you have all these rich Wall Street guys coming in and having their jollies and everything that, you know, when they give them their credit cards, they can then max them out to as much as they can and, you know, take the cash, and they all get rich off of it. And when the guys go to complain, well, what are they going to do? Are you going to reverse the charge in a strip club? What bank is going to do that? So, and then you get kind of a cadre of dancers together, and they're all basically doing this, particularly, you know, for a while, it's going pretty good, but the economy crashes in 2007, 2008, and things, they have to start kind of taking things to another level and actually going out and recruiting people to come into the strip clubs and then stealing them, so, you know, taking them for all they're worth. Or whatnot. Okay, so this film, which I ended up seeing in Toronto, was written and directed by Lorraine Scafaria, who directed a very underrated film, I think, called Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. And a second film called The Meddler with Susan Sarandon and Rose Byrne that I was not as crazy about. And I'm even less crazy about this film. After I saw it in Toronto, my first reaction to the movie was that this is basically drama for the Real Housewives crowd. It's kind of big and flashy. The costumes are great. The personalities are big and bold and these kind of things. But the characters themselves are not particularly that interesting, and as the movie goes on, even less likable. When this movie, early on, when this movie should be having a lot more fun than it actually is, and as Julia Stiles, who plays the journalist in the movie that Constance Wu was telling her story to, says at one point, you know, as far as the Wall Street guys are concerned, I don't really care if they get ripped off. And that's a sentiment that most viewers will probably have. But that doesn't last very long in the movie. It happens, it occurs very early. A lot of these guys get ripped off. You don't mind them seeing get ripped off. But while the women are having fun, the film itself, you know, doesn't seem to be having a whole lot of fun. At least it wasn't sort of, I certainly wasn't. And then, you know, the movie then takes a turn where they're not really just ripping off the Wall Street people. They're ripping off a bunch of schlubs and whatnot. And there's no real great style to the film.
Eric, hang on one second, okay?
Okay.
We've got to take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll find out what Eric thought of the rest of it, of Hustlers. We'll find out what Steve thought of it, and I'll tell you what I thought of it, too. Catching up a little bit from last week, and then we'll jump into the new movies right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and it is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. The Emmys were handed out last night. We'll go through all of that. And then we got things that you never knew about the Emmys and award show scandals from the past. By the way, tomorrow on the show, our good friend Dan Feinberg is going to join us from Hollywood Reporter, TV critic, and he joins us every couple of weeks. But we want to get his thoughts on the Emmys, and we will talk about that even more. Right now, though, we are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. And, yeah, so we've got Eric was just telling us about Hustlers, and let's get Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay. All right, Eric, continue. Hustlers.
Okay. So as I was saying, the movie, while I thought it wasn't very fun when it should be having fun, when it starts to get a little bit more serious, and you start sort of shifting your loyalties a little bit, you know, particularly, you know, amongst the women, not alone the, you know, the fact that some of the guys that they begin to take later in the movie are not quite as deserving of what happens to them compared to, you know, these Wall Street guy jerks that they're dealing with. And then I think the movie kind of embarrassingly tries to bring in, or sort of kind of ham-fistedly bring in, kind of an irony to the Me Too movement involved in what the guys are being getting screwed out of their money. I thought that was handled very poorly. The setup of the movie, I think, is done in such a way that, I mean, if you miss the first 2-3 minutes of the movie, you basically miss all this movie really has to say about the downside of being a professional dancer, or at least someone who does it on the side trying to make a little bit of money. The movie doesn't really have that kind of struggle that you would normally see in a typical movie or a typical story. Jennifer Lopez's character is very well off. Constance Wu is doing stuff for her grandmother. Well, they don't seem to be that penniless, even without the money. I don't know, people touting Jennifer Lopez for an Oscar nomination for this movie, I think, are on a new special breed of crack that I haven't been witness to yet. And I found the last line of the movie particularly embarrassing. And I don't know what people are seeing in this movie, other than a lot of big personalities, Jennifer Lopez, and her extraordinary figure that is brought into play very early in the film. I don't know. I walked out of this movie, found it to be incredibly mediocre.
Wow. Okay. All right. Steve, what about you?
I love this movie. I don't know. I mean, flat is like the last word I would use to describe it, really. I mean, it's high energy. It's like a raging soundtrack. It's splashy and colorful. And like Eric said, there's like an array of beautiful women in all shapes, sizes, and colors. And it's a kind of crazy, wonderful combination. I thought it was funny. I thought the way it gets a little more serious in the back, or like in the last third maybe, really kind of sealed it for me, because it was acknowledging that, like, okay, yeah, crime does pay sometimes, until like the weak link in your little scheme kind of breaks down and gives you all up. But I mean, the film is definitely more than Jennifer Lopez in a G-string, although, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's here. There's messages about empowerment here and how dumb and manipulatable men can be, and we probably don't need to be reminded of that. We know, but then, yeah, like I said, like there is, I don't know if it's the line you're talking about, Eric, but there is a line that Jennifer Lopez delivers about how the world is like a strip club. Is that
that's
the one you're doing? Oh yeah, no, that's way too. That was bad, but it's not like, and certainly unnecessary. But I don't think it undercuts.
It's the final line of the movie.
No, I know, but I don't think it. Yeah. As I'm saying, I don't think that it's the final line of the movie doesn't undercut everything that has come before it. It's totally unnecessary. Like we got that already. We figured that out on our own. I get it, but it's more just underscoring something rather than erasing everything. So. And I, honestly, it was also kind of instructional in the beginning, where Constance Wu was kind of learning to up her game as a dancer. Watching Jennifer Lopez give her pole dancing lessons is impressive. I mean, I feel like I walked out of there thinking I could do it a little better. Don't move if I needed to. So, no, but I mean, it's Lorraine Scafari has this really wonderful gift of sort of making it, giving a crap about the characters and before the laughs or the drama or whatever it is she's going after in whatever movie she's making, she really does want to get us into the heads of these characters a little bit. And I think she achieves that, but I just thought it was also really fun. And after, I don't even know how many years and how many films I've watched where the role of stripper is essentially relegated to the background of a scene that usually is about men being men. It's kind of nice to see that they're not being treated like wallpaper anymore. And it's not like striptease or showgirls either. It's a very, like, attention is given to the lives of these women, and it's almost borderline unprecedented to a certain degree. But I don't think this is a film that's just important. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it just because I thought it was important. I actually think it was a real blast to watch. So,
yeah, I'm with you, Steve. I thought it was terrific. I really, and I'm not a Jennifer Lopez fan at all, but I think she's really terrific in this movie. And man, she's 50 years old. Her, the pole work stuff is impressive. I mean, she's in great shape, man. I like Constance Wu a lot in it. I liked her story. I liked the camaraderie between the women. I think it's really, really fun to watch and flashy, as you guys said. And as the movie chugged along, I was even more with it as the complications arose throughout the movie. And you know, I think this is one of Jennifer Lopez's best performances. And I'm not a big fan, like I said, but let me just say this really quickly: it was a delight to see Mercedes Rule back on the big screen. That just made me very happy. And also Julia Stiles; she doesn't work very often, So to see these two women who I admire greatly really have some fun you know, with the role, especially Mercedes Rule. She's a blast in it. And I liked all the characters. I thought it was an interesting story, and I thought it was well handled. And so I found it to be a really entertaining film that I really, really, really liked a lot. So all right, well, let's move on to this week. All right, Steve, tell us about Villains.
Oh boy. Okay, let's see. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I'm working from memory here. What I remember about it is about a pair of amateur criminals that I think the film begins where they attempt a gas station robbery that kind of goes sideways, and I forget, do they forget the money? Is that what happens or something? They drive away without something that they actually went there for. And they're not only amateurs, they're idiots. And they end up at the breaking into the what they think is an empty suburban home, and they are starting to like case the place, and they stumble upon something kind of crazy in the basement. And eventually the homeowners come back, and they're played by I should say the two criminals are played by Micah Monroe and Bill Skarsgård. They're adorable together. They're very charming, even if they are idiots. But the older couple that arrives at the house, the homeowners are Jeffrey Donovan and Kira Sedgwick. From what I remember, I was a little put off by the performances by the older characters. I thought it was a little over the top, a little too sort of overly Southern polite. It reminded me of something John Waters might have tried a while ago, or did try a while ago, and I think he did it better when it was maybe not so much of a cliche at the time, but I was so sort of charmed by the predicament of the younger couple. And the weird thing is that the overall vibe of the whole thing is fun and lighthearted, even though it's sadistic and sometimes very violent. And the things we're finding out about the older couple are kind of weird and nasty sometimes. It actually has a stranger a vibe that you would not expect from it. I guess you could also read messages into the film about morality and class divisions and kicking aside traditional family unit, but it really seemed like the purpose was fun, and if that's your only criteria, Villains will probably work for you. I don't think I was as shocked by some of the things that were supposed to be shocking here. Maybe I'm just desensitized to sadistic behavior on film these days. I don't know. But, well, when we get to another movie we're going to talk about later, I was not desensitized to it. But yeah, I mean, there's not a lot new here, but I think there's stuff to like, and so I consider this a mild recommendation.
Okay. Eric, hang on. We're going to find out what you thought of it afterwards, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so Eric and Steve are here. We'll take a quick break. We're talking about the movie Villains, and we'll find out what Eric Childress thought of it right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago here until 5 o'clock. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We're going to go through the Emmys, which were handed out last night, and we got award show scandals that we're going to get to as well. Right now, though, it's our weekly meeting with Eric and Steve, where we review all the movies on the Monday morning movie reviews, and then Eric will stick around and we'll talk box office as well. Before the break, Steve told us about a movie called Villains, and Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
Eric, you also saw Villains. Where do you stand on this one?
I did. I'm not recommending this either. This is another movie that I think kind of falls into the same category that I think it's it thinks it's having more fun than it's actually sort of projecting to the audience. I mean, the two leads in the movie, and this is, you know, kind of a, you know, kind of a classic kind of genre setup with two, you know, anti-heroes go into a place and then, you know, an even worse place, and then we have to root for them even harder. And, you know, I agree with Steve that, you know, the performances by Jeffrey Donovan, an actor I've never really cared for, actually, and Keira Sedgwick, are just not that, you know, they're overly broad. Is like they seem to know, like, we have to put on a show here, so let's just try to be as clowny and as over the top as possible, but still within some limit of reality. And it just never, that element never really works. There's like brief moments here and there throughout the film. I think the setup, you know, works pretty well. I like the Monroe and Skarsgård, but there's one moment involving sort of the requisition of, I believe, a tongue ring that I think is the kind of stuff that I was hoping to see more of in the movie, that the movie was going to at least be sort of over the top in, you know, the manner in which they were going to have to try to get away from these characters. And the movie just never really figures out, you know, how to really sort of broaden the expanse of this movie. I mean, it's, you know, more or less, you know, kind of a one set type of story, and it just never really kind of got past its setup for me. I can't quite recommend it.
Okay, so that's Villains, playing at a couple of theaters. All right, Eric, tell us about Zeroville.
Okay, well, this is the latest directorial effort from James Franco, who I think has directed like 30 movies.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah,
it's pretty crazy. I mean, that's almost as much as Steven Spielberg has made, and James Franco's only been directing for maybe a decade or so. But this is based on a novel by Steve Erickson from 2007. It's a story of a young guy who's nicknamed Vickers, played by James Franco, who is in his 20s. He's a big movie fan. The movie, I believe this is the story set in like late 60s, like 1968-69. And he goes to Hollywood. He's got a tattoo on the back of his bald head from a scene from A Place in the Sun of Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor. And he ends up ingratiating himself into the Hollywood scene of that time. And while a lot of names are not used, none that I can remember anyway, we basically get personalities that we can go, hey, I know who that person is. That person's talking about a movie, you know, set in Martha's Vineyard about a shark. I think I know who that character is. So he ends up getting a job as a film editor and becoming infatuated with an actress played by Megan Fox. So the movie just kind of becomes this episodic, freewheeling kind of thing as he is shown to be a very good editor, but basically runs afoul of a couple bigwigs in the business, one played by Seth Rogen, who is more or less playing John Milius, and seems to be working on Apocalypse Now, you know, at the time, and another studio executive played by Will Ferrell. Both of them playing again to the hilt, if you will. James Franco playing it very, you know, level headed, and Megan Fox as the object of lust throughout the story. Other than the disaster artist, I, you know, challenge anyone to think of a James Franco movie that is worth exploring one time, let alone a second time. And this one certainly falls into that category as well. You know, pretension is just all over this thing, as in most Franco productions. Clearly, he's got some... you know, interest in this book. This movie has been held up since 2014 when the studio that backed him went bankrupt. And now, coincidentally, 5 years later, right on the heels of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this movie finally comes out. It's, you know, I mean, I think Seth Rogen is probably the best thing in the movie, doing his, you know, Amilius-type impersonation. Will Ferrell is ridiculous, but you know, if you want to see him be a lot more funnier, watch Between Two Ferns on Netflix. This came out this weekend. And the longer the movie goes on, there are some really potentially interesting things that I assume were probably explored further in the book. The idea that the character, the Franco character, who might kind of be autistic in a way, and he sees movies through a different lens, and believes that they found a secret movie that's actually like hidden one frame at a time in all these different movies that have all been made. Like, I want to see that movie. I'd love to see a greater exploration of something like that. But this is just a bunch of, you know, friends of Franco doing him a favor again, and you know not cheating him. You know, a lot of people in this movie are doing their thing, including Rogan and Ferrell and Craig Robinson. But the movie itself is just so overly pretentious and ultimately just kind of like stupid, that it's just like, what, it's just such a waste of so much talent on a project that just never has any focus whatsoever.
Okay. All right, Steve, what about you?
Yeah, pretension is the theme of this movie, I think. It feels unfinished, like it's a first draft, which I'm guessing that's because the script was probably a first draft, or assuming there was one. There's like a strange sort of energy and enthusiasm that I always get from Franco-directed things, and in certain cases, like The Disaster Artist, I think it works wonderfully. Here, it's strange to me because I think he's sort of failing miserably to capture a weirdness of this book and of this story. I think he set out to make a movie that was weird and surreal, and it's like the label is stamped on the frame, but it's not actually that. And I also think that, like, I can't imagine like genuine cinephiles getting much out of this, because it doesn't exactly dig deep for his reference points or influences or whatever. I also can't imagine casual moviegoers caring much about this either, exactly because of the pretentious tone of the characters or the movie. I mean, if you want to see most of the cast of The Disaster Artist and This Is the End, two movies I really loved together in one movie, this is your one-stop shop. But man, I think one of the only like sort of smaller parts that worked for me was seeing Dave Franco show up at the end as sort of the ghost of Montgomery Clift, because my God, does he look like him? And I think it's just a really nice scene, because it kind of slows down a little bit and gives us a little bit of a peek into Vicker's mind. But this is like right near the beginning of the film. There's a statement that is repeated throughout the film. I think I can say F continuity. That's basically what it is. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh boy, here we go. Because they keep saying it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, now we're in trouble. And half the time you can't even tell what year it is. Like, it's, there are like huge time jumps of many years. Because I think it ends up like in the early 80s or something. And,
What's that? Yeah, because Raging Bull is out by the end of the movie.
Right, because they mentioned Raging Bull. So, like, but the idea that, and I don't think it's, and Eric's right, it's not a coincidence that the opening scene is in 1969, and he's literally arrested as a suspect in the Sharon Tate murder. So, I mean, it is that sort of Tarantino-style thing of intersecting reality with fiction, and, man, this is how you do it, and it goes wrong. But like I said, there is, like, a weird energy to it, and certainly he loves making these movies, and this is actually, I think, shot before The Disaster Artist, so, this has been on the shelf for a while, and, I mean, I'm glad I saw it just to, you know, to keep up with some of these actors were doing a few years ago. But beyond that, I can't imagine anyone liking this.
Okay. All right. Guys, hang out, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Eric and Steve are here. We're going to come back and review more new movies right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and we are going to talk about the Emmys from last night and some other award show scandals and things like that. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Monday morning movie reviews, that's what we're doing right now. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week, and let's get the guys back on. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, so Steve, tell us about Jay Myself.
Oh, sure. This is the title of this documentary is actually about, it came from a mishearing of the name of the subject, whose name is actually Jay Mizell. And for some reason that just really charmed me, and it just made me very interested to know, okay, why would they do that? And it amused me to such a degree that I actually got really invested in the long and impressive life of this grumpy, world-renowned photographer who is known by a lot of people because back in 1969, once again, in New York, he bought a six-story, 37,000 square foot former bank and used it as his home and studio. He bought it for a song and then just sort of filled each of the, I think it's 72 rooms in this place with collected objects, as well as his own sort of photos and slides, although most of it are sort of these curated rooms of similar objects, similar shapes, similar themes, however, whatever he wanted, basically. It was all in his head, and he just sort of put it out there. The film is directed by another photographer and a fellow intern of Mizell's named Stephen Wilkes, and he catches up with at the time in 2015 when the film was made, Mizell was 88, and it was costing him too much money, shockingly, in New York City, although it was in the Bowery, which is now fully, just completely modernized, and there's nothing scary about it anymore, but
right.
Gentrified, that's what I'm looking for. And so he can't live there anymore because he can't afford, like, the property taxes and all that. So he's moving out to another location, although it's still very big. But it's giving them a reason to kind of go through every room and disassemble everything. And Mizell is being, it gives him a chance to reflect it's actually very moving to everyone except maybe Mizell, who is sort of just more fascinated than anything at what he used to do or what he collected, and he's taking pictures the whole time to document it, and he just sort of always sees every situation as a photography opportunity. Sometimes he takes apart objects that we're familiar with and then arranges them in pieces in these sort of new and interesting ways. He's kind of like a hoarder with a more detail-oriented mind. And he's sort of inventing this collection, and there's a really funny moment where someone opens up a drawer in a desk and sees, like, you know, a couple hundred screws that are all exactly the same. And someone's like, can I take one? He goes, no, because that would ruin the collection. And a collection that only he knows about and cares about and wouldn't notice if it disappeared. But because someone asked him, he said no. So, this is the way the guy, but it's fascinating. It's hilarious. And in the last few years, there have been a few documentaries about sort of older New Yorkers, very often creative types, living in these landmark buildings who are or have to relocate for whatever reason. And the cumulative effect of these movies is both sort of melancholy and captivating. You can't help but be amazed by the objects these people have amassed over their lifetime. And a lot of times they've been there for decades. And especially creative types, they just have the most fascinating collections of stuff. And to see it, in this case, it's not just collections. It's not just like he's stacking stuff in a room. He's arranging it. He's like he's making it look aesthetically nice. They do cover his career a little bit, like a brief history, and I love that he sort of sums up his entire style of photography as, hey, look, and that's it. And the more we see of his work, the more sort of awestruck we are by it, and he literally has thousands of photos just taken from the windows, the many, many windows of this building. They might even be collected in a book. I think it's kind of famous, but over decades again. And somehow all of humanity is represented in those photos. And he's a lovable curmudgeon, and I feel fortunate to have discovered him through this film and this beautifully sort of deconstructive process. And the film's playing at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
Okay, just Jay myself. All right, cool. All right, Steve, you're the only one who saw Downton Abbey.
The number one movie of the week?
Yeah, you're the only one who saw it, although I was shocked by the numbers. I got to tell you, I was really... We'll get to the box office in a little bit, but I did not expect it to make over $30 million. My God. So, all right, tell us about Downton Abbey.
It's kind of difficult for me to imagine someone without a working knowledge of the wildly popular PBS drama Downton Abbey, what they would think of a big screen version. But it's also almost equally impossible for me to believe that someone wouldn't be swept up in some aspect of it, whether it's the elegance or the charm or the humor or the intrigue of this of the Crowley family and their small army of servants who prove integral to the success of both the estate and the film. It's set in a home in which class, and I say that with a capital C, is sort of built into the foundation of the building. It may be tough for more modern eyes to get past the idea that being a servant was considered a noble, even enviable position in a certain day and age in England. But since Downton Abbey was always a show that strove for historical accuracy above all else, it would be sort of disingenuous to portray it any other way. So I think that's fairly accurate. The series sort of tended to be more serious and soap opera-ish, and the film has sort of opted for a little bit more of a lighthearted tone, even perhaps in an effort to make it more accessible to people who don't know the series. It's written by the series creator Julian Fellowes and directed by someone who frequently directed episodes, Michael Engler. And they sort of just drop us in on a typical day in the estate that I think is set about a year and a half after the last episode, although the last episode was, I think, 2015. And it's a typical day, and then it's immediately interrupted when a letter from Buckingham Palace shows up announcing that the King and Queen of England are going to be coming to Downton Abbey, popping in on their way to another destination. And when I say King and Queen, by the way, this is King George V and Queen Mary, not the current Queen. Not surprisingly, because of this news, the house is sent into a tizzy in both upstairs and downstairs. What's important to know about the series, and I think that the movie continues this, is that the showrunners never sort of favored the masters or the servants in terms of the amount of time it spent telling the story. So everyone was treated equally in terms of screen time. And so we're sort of caught up on all these lives. And the film does a wonderful job of sort of dropping us in, just updating us a little bit, maybe even, giving some of the characters a turn in terms of their fortunes or whatever, or just, or maybe there is none. Maybe it's just a little bit of an update. For example, the patriarch of the family, Robert, played by Hugh Bonneville, is sort of wondering if it's even worth it keeping such a huge estate together anymore, and he's thinking about selling it or selling pieces of it off. He's been transitioning control of Downton Abbey to his daughter Mary, who's played by Michelle Dockery, and even she seems less than sure that she wants this life for herself. You know, everyone comes back for the most part. There's even a few people that left the show that came back, and as always, with the series, the most relatable character on the show is a character named Tom Branson, who's played by Alan Leach, who, Irish-born former chauffeur who married the youngest daughter, who then ended up, she died in childbirth, but he's still around, and he sort of provides the family with this sort of grounded element. In a lot of ways, he's our entry point into this opulence, and he's always been the most fascinating character, and that is doubly so in this movie. What the staff doesn't realize about this royal visit is that the king and queen are preceded by their own battalion of butlers and ladies-in-waiting and chefs who all basically push out the existing staff, which, of course, doesn't sit well with anybody, and they take steps to make sure that doesn't quite happen. Imelda Staunton shows up as a sort of a distant relative, and she's a really nice addition who it works with the queen, but also happens to hold the power to determine whether Robert is the rightful heir to a great deal of the family fortune. And she seems determined that he isn't, and it led to a big rift in the family. And so she's there, and they're sort of trying to work that out. There weren't really any bad guys in Downton Abbey, unless you count like a would-be royal assassin who barely even registers in this story. But there aren't any. They don't really have any major turns for the worse for any of the characters. Like I said, they were trying to keep things, I think, a little lighter. The film basically feels like a keepsake for longtime fans who just want to know that their favorite characters are doing all right. And I don't know if there are plans to do more, but I kind of hope they do every couple years just so I know what everyone's up to. But if not, I think they kind of leave it on a high note. And I'm eager to see what happens next. But if this is it, that's great. I think it's a terrific film.
Okay, cool. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are here, and we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We've got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
Yeah. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here downtown Chicago. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to recap the Emmys and talk a little bit more about award shows in general. And the movie reviews are happening right now. Steve and Eric join me every Monday morning for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, tell us about Ad Astra.
Okay, this is the new science fiction film from James Gray. It stars Brad Pitt as a guy that, as the movie begins, he is working on this sort of extraordinary antenna that goes from the Earth just about into space when sort of a power surge that has been linked deep within space nearly kills him. And in fact, does kill tens of thousands of people on Earth. He is later briefed by the military that a old project known as the Lima Project that was based put in motion many years ago to look for further intelligent life in the universe, that the surge that's causing all the havoc may be coming from this particular base set up around Neptune. To further complicate matters, the founder or the person in charge of that project was Pitt's father, played by Tommy Lee Jones. So the military is asking him to go to take a ride to the moon. Moon travel has actually been commercialized at this point. There are even subways on the moon at the sandwich shop, not actual trains. And then go from the moon to Mars, to where they want him to transmit a personal message to try to reach out to his father to find out whether or not he is actually purposely putting forth the surge that is happening, or if it's just something that is occurring naturally. So we have this sort of interstellar space adventure on the horizon, but actually one that is far more introspective, more along the lines of 2001 than, say, Gravity. Pitt's character, who narrates the film, is, you know, really, you know, kind of wrestling with the fact that he has just found out that his father is may actually still be alive, someone he has thought has been dead for many years, and now not just that, maybe they're personally responsible for the deaths of several people in the universe. So wrestling with this knowledge and the fact that he has a uncanny knack for having a heart rate that never gets above 80 beats per second is quite a thing, or 80 beats per minute, excuse me. That'd be quite an accomplishment.
It would be impressive.
Yeah. It would, yeah. So he's very, very level-headed, very even-keeled, has to go through these tests, people saw Blade Runner 2049 and saw what Ryan Gosling had to go through, very sort of similar, except tests for humans in this film, and wrestling with this the entire way, and this movie really kind of takes us not just to the depths of space, but really sort of the depths of our own souls, particularly the soul of this character, and I think it does so in a really special way. This film is not, while it does have action sequences, there is a moon chase and guns and a bunch of things that occurred through this thing. It's not exactly what you would call an action-packed science fiction story. Like you said, this is a much more introspective film about the search for father, the search for one's father, so some say the search for God, the idea that God may have, may be out to destroy what he has created, and wrestling with that, and just all kinds of things that sons deal with their fathers, absentee fathers, and this movie really kind of started to hit me in a very personal way. I think Brad Pitt gives one of his very best performances, and that's saying something, coming just off of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. There's a scene about halfway through this movie when he's recording this message where he just kind of goes off script for a moment, and I think it's one of the best scenes that Brad Pitt has ever played in his entire career, which is a pretty remarkable feat in that as well. And this movie looks beautiful. The score is really lovely, but never intrusive. I think that ultimately where this film goes, I think is fascinating. And it's a movie that, again, it hit me on a very personal level. I found this movie boring in any stretch, always something to sort of wrap your mind around, and it really had me thinking quite a bit for pretty much all weekend since I've seen the movie. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it again and having further discussions about it, because I think it's really one of the special movies of the year.
Okay. All right, what'd you think, Steve?
Yeah, he's right. This is definitely like a conversation starter, and the more I've thought about it since I saw it, the more like questions I have, and not because the film is confusing or isn't complete. It's meant to generate questions. It's meant to because obviously at first I was like, wait, I was sort of found myself searching for moments where I could penetrate Brad Pitt's character's like mind a little bit, which is ironic because he's constantly taking psychological tests, so we should know, but we also get a sense that he's sort of manipulating those in the same way he manipulates his heartbeat. And at first I'm like, haven't they figured this out? And I'm like, oh wait, maybe they have figured this out. And they're using it. He's the last person that should go on this mission for many reasons. And I think that's intentional. And I won't even go into why I think it's intentional, because I don't want to spoil anything about when he actually gets to Neptune. But I don't think I'm the only person that's come up with this, but certainly it jumped out at me while I watched it. This is basically a modern telling of Apocalypse Now, or Heart of Darkness, however you want to look at it. It started that briefing where he's being told about this mission initially. They're putting down photos of his father, like he doesn't know what his father looks like. So I'm like, that is exactly like Apocalypse Now. And then he kind of makes all these little stops along the way to get to Neptune, and something really interesting happens in each place, including like a really kind of shocking and terrifying sequence where they find this spaceship that's in distress. But I was not expecting that at all. And even sometimes the action almost seems unnecessary and a little bit like window dressing, but at the same time, I loved it. Like, I thought it was terrific. And yeah, Pitt's performance is very different than what he does in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Here, this is a kid who was sort of grown, like he was sort of a born to be a hero, and he's the son of a hero, and as opposed to this character that he played before, with this guy who's sort of happy to be in the background to a certain degree and not get recognized and stuff. But it's a really, like, the cinematography is stunning. I think it's actually by a guy that had worked with Nolan on a couple films fairly recently. The result is, like Eric said, a really gripping performance by Brad Pitt. And we should say that, like, you should view this on the biggest screen possible, because I can't imagine it looking good small. And I admire it even more, like, the more I think of it. I admire it more than I think I love it, but I still really am recommending it highly. So, okay. Yeah, that's my...
All right. For Complications, I didn't get a chance to see it this week. But I'm really looking forward to it. I hope it, it sounds really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We're going to take one more break, and then we'll come back and review a couple more movies, including another Rambo movie. You guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Steve are here. We're going to take a quick break, and we got more movies to review right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And we're going to recap the Emmys and talk about other award shows and all that cool stuff. Movie reviews are continuing. Steve and Eric join me every Monday morning for the movie reviews, and then Eric will stick around and we'll do some box office figures as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, tell us about American Dreamer.
Ah, okay. So Jim Gaffigan's in a lot of movies, especially this year. I think I've seen him. I think I see him in 5 movies this year so far, and I know he's in at least one or two more probably before the end of the year. He also comes to Chicago a lot, because he was just here last week for this movie, and he was also at the Chicago Critics Film Festival for a different movie. So in American Dreamer, he plays a down-on-his-luck rideshare driver named Cam, who makes probably a lot of extra cash chauffeuring around a low-level drug dealer around town, and he just realizes, like, he's in a situation in his life, as we find out, that he's lost his job, he's lost his wife and kid, he doesn't even have access to his kid anymore because his life is such a mess, and he has no money, and he owes them a lot of money. And so he comes up with this sort of half-baked plan to kidnap the dealer's infant child and then sort of ask for ransom money, thinking he won't get found out. And needless to say, the plan goes sideways almost instantly. And by the end of the film, some truly tragic stuff happens, all of which is Cam's fault completely. And weirdly enough, by the end of the film, he hasn't, and I don't think I'm ruining anything by saying this, he really doesn't pay for any of what he does in the end, which may be a comment on how white guys can basically get away with anything. I don't know. That's what it feels like. But I'm not even sure the director, co-writer, whose name is Derek Borte, I don't think he was really thinking it through to that degree, but it's sort of what it feels like. Like I said, Gaffigan's been in a ton of movies lately, and I'm genuinely been impressed with his sort of shifting range as an actor. But his performance in this movie, it seems like the character is designed to lose him fans. I mean, it's a really serious movie. There's nothing funny about it. I want to make sure that's clear. It's not trying to be funny, and it's not funny. He's kind of an obnoxious, pathetic human being that we're never even really allowed to feel sorry for on any level, despite all these things kind of crippling him. They're all of his making. It's not introspective enough to feel like a Taxi Driver ripoff, even. But it does capture some of that claustrophobia that comes with this particular job and sort of just living this perpetually miserable life. The film isn't especially political, but it does feel like there's a little bit of commentary floating around the perimeters about economic plight and the way cops probably wouldn't even look sideways at someone that looks like him, that looks like Cam, when considering where all the criminals in the world might be. The film is sort of short enough to not hurt too much. It has a moment or two in the acting department and story department that are interesting, but being on VOD, because I don't think it's in any theaters right now, but being on VOD is exactly where this needed to land. So I'm not particularly recommending American Dreamer unless you're a Jim Gaffigan completist.
I watched it. I watched it on the VOD over the weekend, and it's a massive departure for him. And I think he's really good in it, actually.
He is, yeah.
Yeah, and again, it's, you know, you're not covering any new ground here, and he's a completely unlikable character who is at the center of every, you know, of the entire movie.
Yeah.
But it has some really strong moments, and a lot of them have to do with Gaffigan. I think Gaffigan's really, really quite good in this. I mean, there's nothing wholly original about it. We've seen this kind of movie before. You know, it owes to a lot of other movies and better movies. You mentioned Taxi Driver and things like that. But it's got you know, I mean, I was pretty compelled by the, you know, watching the whole thing. I was reasonably compelled, and most of that has to do with Gaffigan. And again, if you're a Jim Gaffigan fan, this is not the Jim Gaffigan that you. not the Jim Gaffigan that you know or love. There's nothing funny in this movie, and he's a real bastard. And he plays it really, really well. I was surprised at how effective he is in this role. I'm a fan of Gaffigan. I think he's great, and I love his stand up. And I just think he's great persona. And he has been in 53 movies, over the past like 2 months. But I think his performance in this one kind of stands out above some of the other movies that he's made. It's not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. Again, you're not covering any new ground, but I think it's worth seeing just because of him. I think he's really great in it. So
I can't go out that quite that far, but I can say he is very good in it. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Eric. Rambo, man.
Last Blood.
Last Blood, baby.
That's right. Okay. So it's been 11 years since the last Rambo movie, properly titled Rambo. At the end of that one, we saw him, John Rambo, finally get to go home. I guess it turned out to be his father's horse ranch or something like that. And as the movie opens, that's where we find him. That, you know, he's out there doing Roy Rogers routines on horses and has built elaborate tunnels on the property. I don't know if he built them himself or his father built them, but they're there. And even as a guy that has extreme PTSD, seems to like to go down in them a lot and build weapons and stuff. He's not there alone. He lives there with or at least a friend of his, played by Adriana Barraza, is there and helps him out on the ranch. She has a granddaughter that is, you know, kind of more or less become like John Rambo's daughter herself. And she has been doing some research on her her father, and a friend of hers down in Mexico. They actually live in the ranches in Arizona. Has tracked down her father that she hasn't seen in years, and she would very much like to go and see him and reconnect with him. But John Rambo knows her father, and knows that he is a really terrible human being. Things didn't work out very well between him and the mother, and he just warns her, you want no part of this, because he's a really bad guy. But being a teenager as she is, she can't help but go down to Mexico, where her friend introduces her to things just don't go well with the father, and next thing you know, she is being kidnapped by a group of human traffickers in Mexico. John goes down to find out what happened to her when, you know, she doesn't come home, and he gets tangled up with the human traffickers himself, and it's eventually going to lead to what you expect out of a Rambo movie, a giant mano-a-mano between John Rambo and an entire army, pretty much. Okay, so the Rambo character, you know, to say that, you know, the Rambo character has become a cartoon, and this is nowhere where we were from John Rambo in First Blood back in 1982, you know, we've gone down that argument before. He's been a cartoon pretty much since, you know, the mid-80s when Rambo First Blood Part 2 was a big success. But, you know, one thing you can say about the John Rambo character of the 80s in those three movies is that the Rambo character was at least sort of representation of some part of America. You know, 1982, he was the Vietnam vet coming home and wasn't really wanted anymore. In 1985, it was the Vietnam vet who was going to correct the mistake of the Vietnam War and bring back our boys. And then in 1988, it was America getting involved in the Russian-Afghanistan conflict. So at least, you know, those three movies you could say something about, and then when he brought the character back 20 years later, it was just, you know, an excuse to blow up people with a giant shotgun. With Rambo Last Blood, which runs all of 78 minutes before the end credits, which then give us a recap of the first, all movies, actually, right up to the fifth movie, gives us a recap of that as well. There's certainly not much to this movie. I'm not quite going down the road just how ugly things get in this movie. There is violence in this movie that shocked even me. And I went in with the attitude that that's exactly what I was going in for. I wanted to see Rambo blow up some human traffickers with his shotgun and, you know, hopefully feel good about it. But there's a moment early in the movie where he does something to a guy in a car that I almost was recoiling in my seat. I could not believe what I was witnessing. And then right up to the, you know, the big confrontation at the end, what he does to one of the people at the very end, I'm like, is he really going to do? and then, you know, sort of everything sort of in between is just kind of reduced to, you know, almost like note cards on a script board. You know, it just seemed like that's all that's written out, and as much as detail as you can get on those note cards, that's what's going to end up in the final print. And that's what it kind of feels like. There's not a lot of build up to the stuff that's from the moment we meet the human traffickers to the commando like closure, and, you know, that's all I wanted was those last 10-15 minutes to really sort of, you know, like, okay, that's exactly what I wanted out of this movie. But even that goes by pretty quickly, as gruesome as the carnage gets.
Okay, Eric, hang on.
Okay.
All right, we got to take a break, and we'll wrap it up here. Eric and Steve and I will tell you what we thought of Rambo Last Blood right after we get back from this, right here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5 a.m. Yeah. Yeah, and Eric and Steve join me every Monday to talk movies, and let's get Eric was telling us about Rambo Last Blood. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, continue, Eric.
Yeah, so I was saying, like, you know, getting up to the ultimate carnage of the climax of the movie, that's kind of all I really wanted to get out of this movie. But even that, with the exception of the kills are spectacular, and that's the kind of thing you're looking for. But it kind of goes by so quickly. It's not a well directed film. By any sleight of imagination. And I actually watched a good bit of the last Rambo movie, which Stallone did. And, quality issues aside, that movie delivered exactly what I wanted out of the climax and is actually a much better directed film. Like you said, this movie is just kind of, it's in fits and spurts. What happens and ends up happening to the teenage girl in this movie is really kind of ugly and depressing, and the movie doesn't have anything interesting to say about human. Not that you can is anything interesting to say about human traffickers, but they're just cartoon characters basically, and they're just meant to be as horrific and awful as possible. And yeah, that's exactly what we want to think about human traffickers. But they insert a character played by Paz Vega, who is completely wasted in this movie as this journalist who's just kind of hopping around bars trying to get a story about this group, and she has a personal connection, personal tragic connection to them as well. The movie kind of blows by those scenes because Rambo just seems to threaten anyone that comes between him and the traffickers. And so ultimately it was very unsatisfying by the end of it. I think that this character deserves better, even if even in a cartoon form. As a weird side note to the release of this movie, internationally, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's actually a longer cut that's being seen by international audiences right now. And not just in a MPAA kind of trim back or scale back the violence kind of way. There's actually like an entire opening prologue that we didn't get here in the States. That actually it's just kind of another action sequence, him rescuing some lost hikers, and I think it's basically to show that he's like really good with local cops now, as opposed to back in 1982. But that scene is completely gone, and actually has a bit of dialogue, I understand, that sets up one of the final shots of the movie. But, we didn't get that here in the U.S. We got a 78-minute version of Rambo Last Blood, and unfortunately, if there's going to be any more like this, if this is what we have to look forward to, I'm kind of glad that it is the Last Blood.
Okay. All right. Steve, what'd you think?
Yeah, I actually would have liked to have seen that scene just to see how life was with the cops after the first one. So, but yeah, there is a weird sense in the beginning of this film that he has sort of turned a corner. I think they're almost trying to fool us into thinking that maybe he's not the same guy he was. And in fact, when he first confronts the traffickers, they just level him. Like, they just brutalize him the first time. And you're like, oh, this is different. But he has even one of the best lines in the film is near the beginning, where the adopted daughter says, you know, oh, people change, you change. And he said, well, I didn't change. I just got to put a lid on it. And that's your first sense that maybe not everything's fixed. I'm sure I wasn't the only one that looked at those tunnels and went, gee, I wonder if this is going to come back into play
later.
So I completely agree with what Eric said. And it in addition to just like being these human traffickers, they're Mexican human traffickers, and they're like the worst people on the planet. I'm sure this film will be on repeat in the White House screening room, the same way like First Blood Part 2 was probably on repeat in the Reagan White House. This movie is kind of reprehensible in the way it portrays most of the Mexican characters. And I'm not someone that gets particularly politically correct about much when it comes to movie watching, but it really just struck me. And having Paz Vega's character, who I actually thought was a nice addition, I wish they'd found a way to keep her in it. I feel like that's saying, oh, there's some good Mexicans too, but I'm like, oh, that's it. The movie's kind of gross in that respect. So by the time we get to those last like 20 minutes or so, which are like the bloodiest installment of the Home Alone franchise that I've ever seen, there's this like booby traps and he's hiding around corners. I'm pretty sure there's even a scene where he cuts a guy's head off and then shoots him. Well, I could be wrong, but that's what I seem to remember in my head. He kills just about everybody twice. And honestly, Eric's right. That's what you signed up for. That's what you paid money for, to see if it would go there again. And it certainly does. And you can't say you can't be disappointed by the action in it. I hope it is the last chapter, because this feels like something that should be gone. That's probably a good thing. It certainly has its moments, like I said, but I'm more torn than I'm probably letting on about how I feel about this, but I guess the ending sold me a little bit, so I'm a little more positive than Eric, but just barely.
Okay. This pretty much was exactly what I was expecting. I mean, you go to see these movies so you can see Stallone kill everybody. Yeah. And he certainly does that, to a monstrous, degree. The whole the plot itself is barely there. The idea is that you go and see these Rambo movies because you want to see Stallone kill people, and he does that. He does that a lot in this movie, and it is really, really short and barely exists. But there are quality kills in this movie. I'm gonna tell you, man.
It's like a horror movie. It's worse than most horror movies.
Yeah, no, and you know, these last two Rambo movies have been insanely violent. I mean, the first three are violent. Well, the first, you know, here's the deal. I try to separate the first movie from the rest of them, because the first movie is a legitimately good film, and I think First Blood is terrific, and I think it's his best performance. I think it's Stallone's best performance. I've always been a really, really huge fan of First Blood, and as the movies have gone on, they've gotten really sillier, and this is as ridiculous a movie as you can possibly imagine. But hey, he kills everybody, and that's what I wanted to see. So, not a great recommendation, but if you want to see Stallone kill a bunch of people, he kills a bunch of people. So, and in very, very gruesome fashion.
I would just recommend just people show up in like the last 15 minutes then.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's
you need to even sit through the first hour of the movie.
No, that's the last 15, 20 minutes is the big payoff. There's no question about it. It's, you know, so, I mean, that's why I went. All right, what do we got next week? Just Abominable?
That's the only major release opening next week.
I think Judy opens next week, too. That's sort of half major.
Oh, right. Okay, that's the Judy Garland movie with Renee Zellweger. Okay, all right. All right, Steve, thank you, man.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks.
There you go. There's Steve. And Eric, let's talk box office.
Okay.
My God, Downton Abbey.
Did
anybody see this coming? $31 million.
No. And no one really saw this coming.
Projections. It beat a Brad Pitt movie, and it beat a Rambo movie by a lot.
Yeah. No, when I went to the theater on Friday afternoon to see both Pitt and Rambo, seriously, they're like, Downton Abbey must have just been letting out, because it was like the entire like senior day, seriously, was letting out of the theater. I'm just like, the theater was abnormally packed for a Friday afternoon. And everyone was going to see the matinees of Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
Obviously. And, I mean, like, again, the initial projections on this were in, like, 11, 12 million.
Yeah.
And then earlier this week, they kind of got close to double. They were saying, like, 19 to 24 million. And I didn't quite know. I mean, because my biggest thing with, you know, why I didn't know where this movie was going to land, not because of the fan base. I know it has a big fan base. But I was thinking, one, are they going to show up for it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a few years since, you know, that series ended. Are they going to show up for it, or are they just going to wait for it to, you know, show up on, you know, cable or DVD or whatever? And Focus Features, not exactly known for big, you know, huge releases. They've only had a few over the years.
Yeah.
And this is the biggest opening they've ever had. The biggest opening they ever had as in their history was Insidious Chapter 3.
Wow.
With 22.6 million.
Wow.
So this is blew this out of the water. And now this has a chance now to beat the all-time grosser, at least domestically, which was Brokeback Mountain.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Ad Astra, 19.2 million. Is that about what was expected?
Yeah, this is pretty good. I mean, pretty much, you know, somewhere in the high teens, maybe the low 20s, people were sort of expecting for this one. It's not a terrible opening. Opened higher than First Man did last year.
Yeah.
For comparing astronaut movies. This one, I think, is going to drop a lot further because
right.
I think most people are not going to know what to make of this movie.
Right.
And this movie cost conservatively $80 million. There was reshoots on it. So the cost on this one is probably a lot higher. So
All right. It's
really going to take a big international haul to make this into a profit.
All right, we're pretty much out of time. But Rambo made $19 million. Chapter 2 is number five is Hustlers. So that's
yeah.
it. So we're looking at that. Abominable will be in number one next week.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's a safe bet.
Okay. All right, Eric. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, man.
There you go. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every week to talk movies. All right, we're going to take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiCilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, on this Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a Monday morning and it's a jokey time. So there you go. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you want to join us. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on our Facebook page. It's interactive. It's constantly updated. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. So last night, the 71st annual Primetime Emmy Awards were handed out. And there were a lot of surprises, lots of surprises on the show. And I want to hear from you guys. What did you think of the broadcast? If you watched it, what did you think of some of the surprises and the winners and the losers and all that stuff? What did you think of the show? 312-981-7200. Again, tomorrow on the show, our buddy Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter, he's a TV critic, joins us every couple of weeks. He's going to make a special visit with us tomorrow to get his thoughts on the broadcast and the winners and all kinds of stuff. A couple of texts have come in, but we want to hear from you on the phones or on the text lines about the Emmy Awards. 312-981-7200. 773 area code says, Nick, I think the Emmys should have categories for basic networks and cable networks. I think it's unfair to pit cable shows, which can do or say anything, against network shows, which are hampered by the standards and practices. A lot of good dramas, comedies, and comedies will never get nominated if this continues. Additionally, those of us who have regular cable and not Hulu, Netflix, etc., never get to see the other shows anyway. That seems to be kind of a common concern now over the years. And in fact, the second text that we have here says, 773 area code says, I enjoyed the show. I wish they had a second show for non-cable shows, though. Yeah, I mean, the landscape is so huge now when it comes to TV. And there are so many ways to, you know, to watch your TV, from your streaming services to cable to broadcast network to, I mean, it's crazy the amount of television that's out there, and sorting through it all is crazy.
And they're going to have to start contending with younger and younger audiences, or as they get older, that just don't have cable.
Right.
Even for stuff that's on AMC, which has been typically a source for some really great golden era of television.
Right. Yeah, it's different, man. I mean, you know, consuming, we talk about this with, you know, we have Dan on regularly, Dan Feinberg regularly, and we always talk about this, the sheer insane amount of television that's out there. And you can't watch everything. You can't. I mean, it's impossible. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have all of the, I don't have all of the streaming services, you know, but I mean, I have enough, and there's... There's definitely enough television to go around.
Sure.
But yeah, I think people, you know, it became sort of a legitimate concern, you know, about the fairness of it when stuff like The Sopranos was winning every year. Because, you know, people were like, well, you can't do the kind of stuff that you can do on HBO that they can do on The Sopranos on like ABC or NBC. And that just seems unfair. You know, to compare those shows and judge those shows against each other when the landscape is just so different. But I got all the winners here. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. The show only went 5 minutes over. There was no host, which I think was okay. For me, the highlight was Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel.
They were great.
They were hilarious. They're absolutely hilarious. Yeah. And, you know, for the most part, there were some big surprises. I got to say, there were some really, really big surprises. Just go, the big one, the outstanding drama series, Better Call Saul, Bodyguard, Game of Thrones, Killing Eve, Ozark, Pose, Succession, and This Is Us were the nominees. Not surprised at all that Game of Thrones won it.
And the thing that stinks is that it's definitely for a kind of overall achievement of the series because... there's a reason it didn't win many other categories, especially in writing and all that kind of stuff, even in direction, which is something that it's been fairly good at over the last, almost decade.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't surprised that it won though. I mean, I didn't expect, I mean, I would have like out of the other nominees, I would have picked Succession.
That would have been an interesting move.
Yeah. Outstanding comedy series, Barry, Fleabag, The Good Place, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Russian Doll, Schitt's Creek, and Veep. And a surprise, Fleabag.
Wow.
What a night for Fleabag.
Yeah, a huge night for everybody involved, and especially for Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is just emerged as one of the most, if not the most, original voice in comedy right now.
Yeah. I was just really surprised that it won. I'm not disappointed either because I think Fleabag's terrific. I just didn't think it was going to win.
Well, the storyline was all about Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other three named comedienne. And, I mean, I don't think she could really be upset, though. Because, I mean, she's got a...
Julia Louis-Dreyfus?
No.
She's got like 800 Emmys.
Yeah.
She's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually thought it was going to go to The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That's what I thought. That's where I thought it was going to go. Because it won last year.
That's true.
Outstanding limited series, Chernobyl, Escape from Dannemora, Fosse Verdon, Sharp Objects, When They See Us. And it went to Chernobyl. Not a big surprise.
No, a huge hit for HBO viewers.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see a little bit more recognition for When They See Us because it was a great limited series, but as a stacked category, there's a lot of great shows in there.
Absolutely. I love Fosse Verdon.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. Outstanding variety sketch series. At Home with Amy Sedaris, documentary now, Drunk History, I Love You America with Sarah Silverman, Saturday Night Live and Who Is America. With the exception of Who Is America, it's a pretty strong category. I can't stand Sacha Baron Cohen. Can't stand him. But all the other ones are really quite funny. I was glad to see Saturday Night Live win, you know, and it was nice of Lauren to acknowledge because they submitted the Adam Sandler hosted because you submit one episode for your awards consideration, and they submitted the episode that they reran Saturday, which is the Adam Sandler episode from this season, and I thought it was pretty cool of Lauren to acknowledge that one of the reasons why it probably won is because of Sandler's tribute to Farley. which was beautiful.
Absolutely. It was great to watch. And yeah. No, it is deserving of recognition. And I think, isn't SNL the most decorated show in Emmy history?
It is. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, it's been on forever.
True. You got 45 years. Yeah.
45 years. I loved when they cut to, after Saturday Night Live was announced the winner, and they cut to Sarah Silverman. They cut to Sarah Silverman, and she was acting like she was asleep. I also love the fact that they recognize, and this is not the first time. It's always weird to me, but they recognize Drunk History, which is a show that just kills me.
It is consistently funny. Derek always. Waters never runs out of ideas, which I can't believe it. You know, you thought the bit would run out at some point, but it's still funny.
It's funny every time. No, it's really funny. And the other thing about Drunk History that's great is that you learn something.
You do.
I'm not gonna lie. I've watched Drunk History and learned something. You know, and. Because it's very factually right on the money. Like, mm-hmm. they want to make sure, like Derek Waters wants to make sure that the stories that they're telling are, in fact, accurate.
And you get to see a lot of comedians that don't make it into mainstream television a lot. Like Rich Fulcher, who is one of the weirdest people I've ever seen on TV.
Yeah.
And he really has only seemed to have a career in, like, some British television of everything. Like, him and Matt Berry were buddies and all that. So it's fun to see lesser-known comedians get a chance.
Also... I don't care. I mean, I've watched every episode of Drunk History, and I think it's a riot. I really do. I love it. But I don't care. Every single time that they cut to Derek Waters laughing, it's hilarious.
He's just got that. He's got that something about him,
and he's got that. He kind of like jumps up and down while he's laughing, and I love the guy. And
because he's legitimately having a good time.
Oh, absolutely.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my favorite moments of that show are when they cut to Derek Waters and he's losing it. Those are my favorite moments in that show. But yeah, Saturday Night Live wins it, and you know, again, everybody up on that stage, you know, they have a huge staff on that show. And I thought it was a good season, you know, not a great season. I thought it was good. All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break here. And, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, I want to hear from you guys about the Emmys. What did you guys think of the show? What do you think of the winners and the losers? What shows do you love? Maybe some of the shows that didn't win or got ignored that you wish would have been recognized. All that stuff. It's Emmy time. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right, welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Yeah, man, Rush. We are here, and it is Monday morning, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. 312-981-7200. Phone lines are open. Text lines are open. The Emmys were last night. We want to get your thoughts on the broadcast itself, the winners, the losers, the speeches, the show. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. 708 area code sends in a text that says, the Emmys didn't recognize The Wire once, so why should I pay them any mind? That's a good point. The Wire was nominated over the five seasons that show was on. The Wire was nominated in one category one year. That's it. It's the best show that's ever been on TV, and it was never acknowledged by the Emmys in the proper way. It got if I'm not mistaken, I think it got a directing credit or a directing nomination for one season, for one episode, which is just absurd. I mean, it's The Wire.
Well, it's one of those things where they kind of win in the long run at the end of the day. The Wire is now looked back while, you know, they got a great five season. You know, show out of it. And if I'm not mistaken, the ratings were never bombastic.
Oh, no,
they
no,
were
no.
always it took solid,
a while,
but...
It took a while for it. People discovered The Wire on DVD. That's how they discovered it. Because the ratings were pretty low. It started to increase a little bit. But by the fifth season, by the last season, the ratings were good. Because it took five seasons for them, you know... to catch on. But it's, I mean, now, I mean, obviously people look back and go, well, that's the best TV show ever. I mean, it's arguably most people who have seen it regard it as the best TV show in the history of television.
Yeah, and its influence is unmistakable. So I think at the end of the day, they lost the battle but won the war.
Yeah,
in terms.
I mean,
of
it is considered. I mean, you know, you look back at, you know, all the stuff that David Simon has done. It's all great. I mean, he's just one of the most gifted and talented and brilliant men to ever work in television, you know? 847 area code says, Nick, I didn't watch the show. Did Billions win or even get nominated? Thanks. No, I didn't even get nominated. But I don't know if that has to do with... We'll have to ask Dan tomorrow if that has to do with... when it aired, because I know there's like that deadline,
yeah,
you know, where maybe Billions started, after the deadline. But have people been nominated for that show? That show's been nominated, right? Giamatti get nominated for that?
I want to say yes. Confirm that.
Okay. All right. Well, what else do you guys think? 312-981-7200. Outstanding supporting actor in a comedy series: Alan Arkin, The Kominsky Method. Anthony Carrigan for Barry. Tony Hale for Veep. Stephen Root for Barry. Tony Shalhoub for Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And Henry Winkler for Barry. But everybody from Barry got nominated. I think they kind of canceled each other out. I would have loved to have seen Stephen Root win.
That would have been really interesting.
Yeah.
Because his character, Fuchs, on Barry is something else.
But the best was the clip that they showed. You know, when they were doing the introduction, they come say, "What are you?" With the Ronnie Lilly episode with the little girl.
It's such a great representation of Stephen Root's, like, style of just who he is.
What are you? Tony Shalhoub won, which is not a surprise that he won last year. He's an awards machine, Tony Shalhoub. You know?
I mean, what a career in television he's had.
Incredible. And in movies and on stage. Yeah. Band's Visit.
The guy's insane.
The guy won a Tony for The Band's Visit.
And I can safely say that from what I can find, Billions has never even been nominated for an Emmy.
Wow, that's surprising.
That's, you know, strong performances in that show, though. I like the show.
Yeah. Outstanding supporting actress in a comedy series: Alex Borstein for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Anna Chomsky for Veep, Cian Clifford for Fleabag, Olivia Colman for Fleabag, Betty Gilpin for Glow, Sarah Goldberg for Barry, Maren Hinkle for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and Kate McKinnon for Saturday Night Live. And Alec, not surprisingly, Alex Borstein won it. Are her and Seth MacFarlane, are they an item?
I don't know. It seems like they could be. I mean,
they work together all the time. I know that.
Right, because she's Lois Griffin on Family Guy.
Right.
I didn't see... I looked it up immediately after I saw they had that little moment.
They did. And on the red carpet, when they were interviewing them before the red carpet, I was like, wait a minute, are they a couple? I mean, it's cool. I mean, I just didn't know that. Alex Borstein and Seth MacFarlane.
And her speech was really something.
Yeah. Well, she's great. And I love the fact that she was drinking booze when they cut to her.
The little mini
bottle of booze right there. Yeah, no, she's great, and you know, she's terrific on the show. I've always been a fan of hers. Outstanding writing for a comedy series: Ronnie Lilly for Barry, episode 1 for Fleabag, Anna Inish Peters for Pen 15, Nothing in This World is Easy for Russian Doll, Warm Body for Russian Doll, for Good Place, and for Veep. And it went to Fleabag, which was another surprise. I would have loved to have seen Ron Lilly. Ronnie Lilly win, especially for this next category, which was outstanding directing for a comedy series. Alec Berg got nominated for The Audition for Barry, but Bill Hader got nominated for Ronnie Lilly, which is just the most beautifully directed piece of TV I saw all of last year. Mark Chandrowski for The Big Bang Theory, Harry Bradbeer for Fleabag, Amy Sherman-Palladino for Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and Daniel Palladino for Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and it went to Henry Bradbeer from Fleabag. Fleabag just cleaned up.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a tough category, because look at everybody in there. We're talking about the cream of the crop in terms of comedy directing right now.
Yeah.
You got legends in there.
Yeah.
With Amy Sherman-Palladino and Daniel Palladino. I mean, good for Fleabag for you know, coming
out.
They
seriously stepped it up, man. I mean, I was really surprised at how well Fleabag did. I mean, it won almost everything it was nominated for.
Mm-hmm.
So, and especially in the major categories. Okay, did you watch the Emmys? 312-981-7200. What did you think of the show? What did you think of the broadcast? What did you think about it being hostless and winners and losers and all that cool stuff? More of it right after this, and we go to the news after this. All right, welcome back. Yo, yo, yo. I love the police. Hi, Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago, 18 stories above beautiful Chicago. And we're talking about the Emmys. They were handed out last night. Overall, we want to know what you guys thought of the show and the winners and all that cool stuff. So we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. We also are going to be talking about some of the other award show scandals that rocked the industry. And you got some surprising things that you might not have known about the Emmy Awards in general. And again, tomorrow, Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter, TV critic, who joins us every couple of weeks, will give us his thoughts on the winners, the losers, the show itself. Here's Linda on WGN. Hi, Linda. Linda?
Hi, Nick.
Hi.
I had to tell you, the award show was horrible. I mean, you felt like you were watching a high school production. There was nothing that tied it together. But the whole thing, the only reason I watched was Billy Porter. What a wonderful thing that he won.
Yeah.
That show was fantastic. It was just, it was joyous.
Yeah, no, it was definitely one of the highlights of the show, without question, was Billy Porter's win and his speech. It was definitely, absolutely one of the highlights of the show, no question.
Yes, it was fabulous.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you, Linda.
Bye.
Take care. Yeah, Billy Porter from Pose. 301 area code says, the fact that it was hostless may have been one of the reasons why it only ran 5 minutes over. Yeah, there's no question about it, because, you know, if you've got a host, you got a 15-minute monologue at the beginning of the show.
What was your take on the whole Thomas Lennon thing?
It didn't work.
Yeah.
I love Thomas Lennon.
He's great. But
didn't work. They've tried that in the past, too, and it just doesn't work. Having some dude, you know, making comments or something. And the writing was bad.
Yeah, I don't know if he was being fed lines or if he was trying to come up with them off the cuff, but he's a really funny guy, so it seemed odd for him to be so flat.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't work. Outstanding lead actor in a comedy series went to Bill Hader. Which I got to say, I'm really thrilled. I mean, this is 2 years in a row now that he's won it. But I really thought Michael Douglas was going to get it because he's Michael Douglas. I really did. But I was really happy to see. And his speech was great. Bill Hader's just great. Outstanding lead actress in a comedy series, Phoebe Waller-Bridge for Fleabag. Again, huge. Outstanding reality competition show went to RuPaul's Drag Race. Now, that's how many times has that won now?
Oh, geez.
I mean, it wins every year. Remember when The Amazing Race won every single year?
Yeah.
Because it was the deal. It was The Amazing Race. And I know that, because my favorite, obviously, is Top Chef. And I know that that's won a few times. But this RuPaul's Drag Race, man, I mean, crazy. Johan Renck for Chernobyl. He won for directing a limited series or a movie. Ben Whishaw for A Very English Scandal, supporting actor in a limited movie or a series.
I was kind of surprised by that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know.
I mean, I saw the miniseries. It was very well done. It was good. It was really good, but I don't know if it was better than some of the other stuff in the category.
For writing on a limited series, they chose Chernobyl. Lead actor in a limited series or a movie went to Gerald Jerome for When They See Us. That probably got one of the biggest responses of the night. Outstanding TV movie, Bandersnatch from Black Mirror. Now, again, we'll talk to Dan about this tomorrow, but he hates the fact that Black Mirror is considered a TV movie.
Yeah, I don't know how that specific. It's just an episode of
an anthology series. It's a television series.
They cheated, essentially.
Yeah, and they cheated Deadwood out of what was a deserved Emmy. Outstanding lead actress in a limited series, Michelle Williams from Fosse Verdon, absolutely deserved it. Absolutely great speech. I think one of the highlights of the show, and then followed closely by supporting actress in a limited series, removing Patricia Arquette in the act. Another great speech.
Yeah, I was honestly starting to cry.
Yeah.
When she was talking about Alexis, it was a really tough thing. But you know, she was up there putting it out there.
Writing for a variety series, of course, it went to Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which is deserved.
I know it kind of stinks.
It's every year it wins
because it's just so well written. I don't know where you find these writers.
It's brilliant, and the show is brilliant. I mean, it's like when, you know, because every year it used to be The Daily Show would win, and then it went to Colbert Report, and now it's John Oliver. Those are the, you know, because every year you knew that these, you know, in that world, like when it was John Stewart on The Daily Show, they won every year. When The Colbert Report came out, he won every year, and now it's John Oliver.
And when it comes to RuPaul's Drag Race, it hasn't won every year for the reality competition program, but it's won every year since 2016 for Outstanding Host for RuPaul.
Oh, sure. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Totally makes sense. RuPaul rules.
He's awesome.
Directing for a variety series went to Don Roy King for Saturday Night Live. He's been doing it forever. He's won a bunch of times. But they particularly chose the one that the Adam Sandler won. Outstanding Variety Talk Series again, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. I just can't believe the Late Late Show was nominated with Corden. How is that possible?
I don't think anybody in that room even likes James Corden.
Oh,
because
you got The Daily Show, Trevor Noah rules.
Yeah.
You got Full Frontal, Samantha Bee rules. Jimmy Kimmel Live, terrific show.
Yeah.
Then you got Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and then you've got The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And then
The Late
Corden.
Late Show.
Like, what? I mean, the drop in quality from all of those titles that I just mentioned.
His only real claim to fame here is that damn carpool karaoke.
That's it.
So stupid.
That's it. Outstanding supporting actor in a drama series. Who did it go to? It doesn't have this listed here. Who won this? I don't even remember. Alfie, Game of Thrones. It didn't go to anybody from Game of Thrones, right? Jonathan Banks, Better Call Saul. Giancarlo Esposito. I don't know.
In a drama series, it was Peter Dinklage.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, it was Peter Dinklage.
Of course.
And he was great.
Always. Writing went to Succession for a drama series.
Absolutely deserved.
Supporting actress for a drama series went to Julia Garner for Ozark. That was another big surprise. But I think the problem was that, like, everybody from Game of Thrones kind of canceled each other out because four women from Game of Thrones were nominated. Outstanding lead actor in a drama series. I was waiting for Jason Bateman to win and then Dan Feinberg's head would explode. He did win directing.
He did.
Jason Bateman won directing. We'll have to find out what... I have to find out what Dan Feinberg thinks of that.
I did not realize how much he does not like Ozark.
Oh, he can't stand it.
I think it's okay.
I don't hate it.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like a poor man's Breaking Bad at times, but
yeah.
It's not terrible.
But Billy Porter ended up winning for Pose, and again, one of the highlights of the show.
So great.
Yeah. Directing for a drama series, as I just said, Jason Bateman won. But it's insane, though, it's really insane that he won considering the competition. Like, the competition's insane.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, oh, jeez. I mean, just the fact that Miguel Sapochnik did not re-up his get another win for Game of Thrones. But I think it's because he was nominated for The Long Night, which was the episode everybody complained they couldn't see.
Right.
Even though... you know, it's not totally his fault. He's kind of constrained with the way that they do things on the set, but I still think that it was pretty shocking that Ozark would get a Best Directing.
Yeah. And then Best Lead Actress in a Drama Series went to Jodie Comer for Killing Eve, another surprise. But that, again, was a really strong category, too. So there you go. Those are the results. If you guys want to jump in, 312-981-7200 for your thoughts on the Emmy Awards. I thought the show was fine.
I was there for the speeches, really, and just to see who won.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, going hostless, I guess, you know, cut your length down a little bit. So as far as, like, presenters go, like I mentioned, Colbert and Kimmel, I thought were great. Maya Rudolph and Ike, what's his
face? Barinholtz.
Hilarious.
With the blue blockers.
Hilarious. I love the fact that they were mispronouncing everybody's name except for Ted Danson.
Yeah.
Like, that was fantastic.
That did get a legitimate belly laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Out of me. I
absolutely.
That was pretty good.
Yeah. 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 As far as speeches go, you know, obviously, Pose was huge. And, yeah, I mean, there was the Patricia Arquette's speech was great.
Michelle Williams, though, is getting talked about a lot. I think her and Billy Porter, and then the kid from When They See Us, when he dedicated the win to the Exonerated Five, I thought was who were there.
Yeah, yeah, they were there.
Really,
it was
really
great.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's take a quick break here. I'll give you some weather, and then when we come back, we've got the phone lines are open, the text lines are open, and we're talking about the Emmys. And I've got some surprising things that you might not know about the Emmys, and some awards show scandals from the past. 312-981-7200. What do you think of the Emmys and all that cool stuff? 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday. And it's jokey time. And also coming up is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right here on 720 WGN. All right, the Emmys were handed out. And we've got some surprising things that you might not have ever known about the Emmys. And also, we want to get your thoughts. 312-981-7200. What'd you think of the winners? What'd you think of the losers? What'd you think of the show? Yeah. So, wonder how the ratings were.
Yeah, we'll have to. I think we'll have those numbers.
Yeah, tomorrow.
Tomorrow with Dan, but I don't know. It seems it could be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I missed Big Brother for it. So that should tell you something right there.
Was last night kind of like a recap? Because tonight's the final thing, right?
No, Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Yeah,
okay.
Wednesday night, 8:30. It's 90 minutes. And it's the whole wrap-up. Last night's episode, I was over at my folks' house watching the Emmys, and my mom was in the kitchen watching Big Brother, and I could kind of see the screen from there. But there was another, like a three-part competition. It was one of those, you know, three-part competition things. Of course, Mickey won the first round of it. Nicole came in last. I hope she doesn't get eliminated. And it'd be down to those two jerks, Holly and Mickey.
Knuckleheads.
But I'm rooting for Nicole all the way. But what they did was, it was sort of like a recap of how they got to where they were now. And then they brought back Casey, JC, and what's the surfer guy's name?
Oh, God.
With the hair. Tyler.
Yeah.
So they brought them back, and Julie interviewed them on how they think that how the contestants have been playing the game. But it ended with, you know, the competition is still going to be going. So, like, on Wednesday, they'll finish the three-part competition. Somebody gets booted. They bring the jury back. And it's live, and it's 90 minutes long. So that's what happens on Wednesday.
Yeah. So they'll make Thursday morning very interesting.
Yeah, we'll see. I think Mickey's going to win it. I really do. I don't want him to. But he's, you know, he's a bit of a beast, man. I mean, seriously, he's a comp beast. I gotta tip the hat. Can't stand the guy, but I gotta tip the hat. He's playing the game.
Credit where credit is due.
Yeah. But I'm rooting for Nicole. She's adorable. She's funny as hell, too, man. So. All right, here are some things that you might not know about the Emmy Awards. 6 awards were given out at the first ceremony. Just 6. The very first Emmy Awards, held on January 25th, 1949 at the Hollywood Athletic Club, was a low-key affair compared to today's spectacle. Tickets to attend just cost $5. And only 6 awards were handed out that night. Original award categories included Most Popular Television Program, Best Film Made for Television, and Most Outstanding Television Personality, among others.
Most Outstanding Television Personality.
Winners must pay $400 for their own statuette.
Wait, what?
Some Emmy Award winners must fork over a pretty penny if they wish to take home a statuette. Because each trophy costs an estimated $400 to make, the Television Academy often charges extra fees if certain winners, such as large writing teams, want to receive multiple statuettes. Yeah.
I guess that makes sense.
I mean, look, man. When John Oliver won, how many people were on stage when John Oliver, Last Week Tonight won?
But
for writing.
Who gets the freebie? Because one of those.
John Oliver.
If John Oliver gets to keep it?
Yeah.
Ah, man.
He's a writer on the show.
He is. But I'm sure he started passing. They've won a couple of times now.
Yes.
So I'm sure he passes it, starts passing them around.
Oh, I would imagine that he's, you know, pretty cool about that. You know, I wouldn't, you know, like I'm not going to hog all the Emmys. The shortest Emmy acceptance speech was 11 words long. Actress Merritt Weaver pulled off a major win in 2013 for her supporting role in the TV show Nurse Jackie. But when she took the stage to accept the award, Weaver kept her remarks short and sweet. Her acceptance speech totaled just 11 words. Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you so much. I gotta go. Bye.
I wonder if that is shorter than... what's his name?
Joe Pesci.
Joe Pesci.
Oh, no. Joe Pesci's he says like 3 words.
Yeah,
it's my privilege. I think that's it.
It's my privilege. Thank you.
That's it. Gone.
And I'm not going to count the thank you.
I remember watching that because he won for Goodfellas. And I remember watching it. And, you know, it's Joe Pesci. I wanted to hear him talk because it's Joe Pesci. And for such a memorable role, you know what I mean? Also based on a real guy. So you would think that he would have a lot to say.
People
loved it though. I mean, it was like they cut to the audience and the audience was like, okay. I think that's the shortest acceptance speech like in any award show history. Certainly the Oscars.
Yeah. Well, that's Joe Pesci for you. He leaves it all out on the field.
Yeah. Oh man. This one I knew. The Emmy statuette is modeled after a TV engineer's wife. Did you not know this?
No.
Emmy Award founder Sid Kasin rejected 47 design proposals for the Emmy's famous statuette before he finally settled on the one we all know and love today. The design featured a woman with wings that represent the arts, holding an atom to symbolize the sciences. Lois McManus, a television engineer and the design's creator, had the figure... made after his wife.
So she's a literal trophy wife.
Yeah.
Nice.
Here's one. Here's a nice little fact for you. A ventriloquist won the very first Emmy. At the first Emmy Award ceremony in 1949, 20-year-old Shirley Dinsdale became the first person to receive an Emmy, along with her puppet named Judy Splinters. For a role as a ventriloquist on a popular variety show. The two leading ladies later starred in a children's show named after the puppet, Judy Splinters.
So the Emmy Awards, 71 years of passing out awards to dummies.
Yeah. Well, literally.
Literally. Jeez.
Networks pay up to $500,000 just to get nominated. Racking up Emmy Awards isn't all fun and games. In fact, television networks shell out big bucks just to get their series nominated for a prize. It is estimated that each network pays between $150,000 and $500,000 before they even arrive at the ceremony, covering the Television Academy's fees and costs for producing and distributing DVDs, among other things. Wow.
Was this the first time that the Emmys was on Fox? Or was
no,
that...
it's been on before.
Okay. Because I always remember...
No, it was on Fox. Remember, because last year, Andy Samberg and...
It was Andy Samberg and Sandra Oh, right?
And Sandra Oh last year, yeah.
And that was on Fox.
Yeah, it was on Fox.
Okay.
The yellow first down line seen on NFL broadcast won an Emmy. What? We'll get to that details on that one after we because that's just ridiculous. So the yellow first down line on NFL broadcast won an Emmy. We'll give you all the details on that. If you want to jump in with your thoughts, 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. The news is up after this. All right. Welcome back. How's everybody doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's a Monday morning, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on, because it's a jokey time. And we've been talking about the Emmys. The Emmys were handed out last night. A pretty entertaining show. Lots of surprises especially in the comedy category, where Fleabag just cleaned up. A great show too. So, but I just didn't expect that, but I'm happy for the show and for the woman who basically does everything on that show. So Phoebe Waller-Bridge, she's great. So, yeah, I also thought it was cool that, when it won, you know, best comedy show, that she got the award from Norman Lear. You know, that's pretty cool. I mean,
that's a real passing of the torch.
I mean, it's one of the most legendary television creators of all time, responsible for some of the best shows in the history of television. She got that award from him.
I thought it was funny because she won for writing and then for acting, and she used the same speech, but she switched out writing for acting.
Yeah.
Something to the effect of, writing is actually really difficult for me, and it's really hard to do, so it's really nice to win this. And then she did the same speech for acting, and it got a good laugh.
Yeah. Yeah. It was cool. I also thought that when they brought the entire cast of Veep out, that was hilarious. But that's, you know, that show was consistently one of the funniest shows on TV. It really was. But when they brought everybody out on stage, Veep, I mean, Tony Hale is hilarious. Tony Hale is hilarious. But it's such a great show. I mean, Veep is just so smart and funny, and has been for the entire, you know, length of its existence. So, all right, we got some more more fun facts about the Emmys. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. We busted out this golden nugget before the news. The yellow first down line seen on NFL broadcast won an Emmy. How does that happen? Actors and television shows are not the only winners on Emmy night. Televised football's yellow first down line, also called first and 10, was once honored too. Developed by technology company Sports Vision and ESPN, the graphic debuted in 1998 during a game between the Baltimore Ravens and the Cincinnati Bengals. It won two Emmys for technical achievement. Wow. Well, people, you know what? I mean, it's everywhere now.
Yeah, I don't know, because obviously I've only grown up in a world where the first and 10 line has existed on television. So how did people watch football games without it? I don't know.
You'd keep an eye on the chains on the side of the,
I know,
on the sideline.
It's just such a nice little visual aid.
No, it is. And I mean, obviously there's a reason why it's so popular. People just love it. But sports graphics have just completely changed. You know,
well, even with hockey, don't they highlight the pucks?
No, they tried that.
They tried that for a while.
Stupidest thing ever.
Yeah.
I remember just being like, you got to be kidding me. Like they put like a blue dome over the Over the puck, so that you could keep an eye on it, because people were like, you know why nobody watches hockey? Because they don't know where the puck is.
You just have to get used to it. When I first started watching hockey, which I did not grow up in a hockey household, it was basically when the Hawks started winning, all of a sudden we started watching hockey a lot more.
Yeah. Well, that's the case with a lot of people.
Yeah, I ain't ashamed to say it.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how it is.
Right around 2008, 2009, people started, you know, well, exactly. 2010, they won the cup, so...
Yeah, that's when they captured me, and I was, maybe a sophomore in high school?
Yeah, 2010, 2013, 2015, those are the cup, you know.
And it was miserable trying to get used to watching the rate of play, but now it's
I don't know, it's just easy. That hockey is one of my favorite sports, and I've been watching it since I was a kid, and so I've never had any difficulty following hockey. I don't know. I guess people get confused by it. I mean, you know, some of the rules are a little bit, you know, like try to explain icing to somebody.
Oh yeah, that was a really weird 20-minute conversation I had with someone. I was like, wait a second.
Yeah,
but luckily I grew up watching soccer, so it's not totally foreign.
Right. As we mentioned before, Saturday Night Live is the most decorated show in Emmy history. It helps that it's been on since 1975. You know what I mean? You're going to win a lot of Emmys if you're on for 45 years. Saturday Night Live boasts the most Emmy victories ever, beating out favorites like the Academy Awards itself and the Olympics broadcasts. Wow.
Maybe if the Olympics were funnier.
Since its first telecast in 1976, the sketch comedy has received 76 wins and a whopping 270 nominations in categories ranging from directing to writing. Wow. Wow. About this, it takes over 5 hours to make one Emmy statuette. Employees at R.S. Owens, a Chicago-based manufacturing shop, spend 5.5 hours molding and coating every statuette in copper, nickel, silver, and gold. And at the end of the day, the statuettes weigh in at nearly 7 pounds each. It's pretty heavy. Jackie Kennedy was the first and only First Lady to receive an Emmy Award. Jackie Kennedy's famous televised tour of the White House in 1962 earned her an Emmy nod, making her the first and only First Lady of the United States to ever win the award. Lady Bird Johnson, the wife of then Vice President Lyndon Johnson, was in attendance and accepted the award on Kennedy's behalf. It's now displayed at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston, if you want to see her Emmy. There were some very unusual award categories in the past, including categories like Outstanding Lead Actor and Outstanding Drama Series. Might sound straightforward, but they have not always been that way. Back in the day, the Emmys tested an award for Best Continuing Performance in a Series by a comedian, singer, hostess, dancer, MC, announcer, narrator, panelist, or any person who essentially plays themselves.
Wow.
Along with similar categories for males. Unsurprisingly, those two award categories were nixed the following year.
I like that it ends in, or anybody who essentially plays themselves.
Yeah. That's got a real good ring to it.
Yeah, it's the catchiest award of the evening.
Someone nearly stole an Emmy on stage. Oh, I remember this.
When was this?
Oh. It was 1985. I totally remember this. In 1985, actress Betty Thomas won Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Drama Series for Hill Street Blues. But a mysterious man appeared on stage and accepted the Emmy before she could. The prankster was Barry Bremen, nicknamed the Great Imposter, who had pulled off similar pranks at large events like the Super Bowl. He ended up with a $175 fine, 6 months probation for the stunt. This guy was everywhere, this dude, pulling all kinds of stuff. He would get into these, and people would go, how is this guy getting entrance to these places? How did he get up on stage? I mean, you know.
It seems like it's a confidence thing. Like, if you act like you're supposed to be somewhere, a lot of people just, like, don't even care.
Two video game controllers have won Emmy Awards. Believe it or not, even video game controllers can walk away with Emmys. Sony's original DualShock analog controller and Nintendo's NES Famicom controller received awards in 2007 at the 58th Annual Technical and Engineer Emmy Awards.
Why 2007?
I don't know.
That's like decades after they were introduced.
The Emmy was named after a video camera tube. Back in the 40s, Television Academy named a title, needed a title for its new awards ceremony. One member suggested IMMY, I-M-M-Y. That's the name of the of a tube inside a video camera that captures moving images. But the team wanted to sound a little bit more feminine, so the to match the female statuette, they tweaked it to Emmy with an E. How about this? A Supreme Court justice once hosted the ceremony. The third annual Primetime Emmy Awards in 1951 held a special and unusual host, Earl Warren. The governor of California at the time, Warren went on to become Chief Justice in the United States Supreme Court, leading some people to wonder if they'd been better a better Emmy judge instead. And then finally, Betty White has received an Emmy nomination in six different decades, and she's won in four. Over her nearly 80-year career, actress Betty White has racked up over 20 Emmy nominations and took home five trophies. White's most recent Emmy win, honoring her appearance as the host on Saturday Night Live in 2010, made her the oldest Emmy winner ever at 88 years old. In September of 2019, she lost that title to Norman Lear, who's 97, who won for his TV special live in front of a studio audience, Norman Lear's All in the Family and the Jeffersons.
There you go.
Yeah. I forgot he was 97.
God, he doesn't look too bad for 97.
He looks great.
He looks pretty good for 97.
He looks great. All right. All right. Let's take a break here for some weather, and then we've got award show scandals that rocked the industry in honor of the Emmys being handed out. And the phone lines and text lines are open if you want to jump in with any comments or thoughts. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 floors above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Last night was the Emmys. What did you think? 312-981-7200. If you want to jump in with your thoughts on the show itself, on the winners, on the losers, on the surprises. And there were lots of surprises on last night's show. So we also have some award show scandals that rocked the industry to talk about, too. So 312-981-7200. 219 area code says, "Hey, Nick, encourage Tom to watch the 1985 Bears games. It will bring him closer to the greatest football team ever and help him understand how we used to watch football back then." All right. Okay. So here's the deal. You got name gaffes, you got victorious felons, fist fights, sexist gags, controversial kisses and cameos, Oh My Award shows, often aired live and starring the world's richest and most famous players, have seen their fair share of scandals over the years. But the show must go on. Like, for instance, at the 2014 Emmys, many feminists, social media users, and critics alike slammed a sight gag featuring Sofia Vergara and Television Academy Chairman Bruce Rosenblum. The joke literally placed the super sexy Modern Family star in a slowly revolving pedestal with her curbs on full display. Rosenblum ended his boring speech about the state of the of TV with what seemed like a justification for the sex sells mentality. What truly matters is that we never forget that our success is based on always giving the viewers something compelling to watch. Vergara didn't understand the backlash. She told Entertainment Weekly that she did not see the gag as demeaning. It's absolutely the opposite. It means that somebody can be hot and also funny and to make fun of herself. Sometimes somebody started this who has no sense of humor. I don't think I remember. Yeah. Here is Frank on WGN. Hi, Frank.
Hi. You're not coming through to good, Nick. I can't hardly hear you.
Okay.
Oh, that's better.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering what happened to Viggo Vendemmia. I thought him and the one that plays his wife should have won. Or, if not both of them. And also another thing, I mean, I like looking at beautiful women and this and that, but I think that most of them, those tops that the woman wore, were over-revealing. And it's like, to me, it's unnecessary.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, that's fair enough. But they always talk about the fashion. Like, for instance, on E! Tomorrow, they'll spend 7 hours talking about what the people wore.
It's true.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those nights where people get all dressed up, and sometimes it's a little revealing. You know what was really funny, though? By the way, I love Kristen Bell. Let me just say that right now. I love her. And I think The Good Place is a great show, and I think deserved more recognition than it got. But I also loved when she came out with Don Cheadle and said, how does it feel to lose 9 times in a row? Don Cheadle's just like, read the thing.
She's got quite a sense of humor.
Yeah. Oh, she's funny, man. Frank, thanks. Thanks for the call, buddy. Yeah, Milo. How do you say his last name?
Milo Ventimiglia.
I just call him Jess. I don't even call him by his real name. I just call him Jess.
Yeah. Milo Ventimiglia.
Okay. 815 area code says, I didn't think the opening bit with Ben Stiller and Bob Newhart was at all funny. Awful, actually. Yeah, it didn't go over very well. But it's Bob Newhart, though.
Yeah, Bob Newhart's just, he's game
Newhart.
For anything.
He's Bob Newhart. He's the king. Guy's amazing.
I did think it was funny when he told Ben Stiller he didn't like him in Tropic Thunder.
Yeah.
I thought Bob Newhart was the best part of that bit.
Yeah.
Just because he just kind of didn't want to be there.
Well, what's really amazing is that you know who his best friend was? Don Rickles.
Oh, yeah.
Could you imagine hanging with those guys?
Oh, my God.
Come on.
Well, I got to see Bob Newhart at Loyola because he's a Loyola alum,
right.
And they dedicated their theater to him. It's the Bob Newhart like family theater or something like that. And he was just the best.
No, he's
so
the best.
Funny.
And his both of his shows, the one that takes place in the inn with Larry, Daryl, and Daryl, and the classic one, the Bob Newhart show, is a brilliant show. And it's still to this day, it's timeless. And man, Suzanne Plachette. Oh, man. How about this one? This was just absolutely insane. We all remember this. We're talking about award show scandals and award show weirdness based upon, the fact that we had the Emmys last night. But this is probably one of the most legendary ones that everybody is going to remember forever. February 26, 2017. Is an Oscar night that will live in infamy. Former Bonnie and Clyde co-stars Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty were presenting the Best Picture category. Beatty looked confused as he pulled the winner's name out of a red envelope and tossed it to Dunaway, who called out La La Land. The team behind the musical rushed the stage and started gushing, giving thanks and suggesting that more people make bold and diverse work. During the second and third speeches, men in headsets started gathering on stage and inspecting envelopes while the faces of the cast and crew started to change. Producer Justin Horowitz then announced that Moonlight had actually won and held up the correct card. Shock spread throughout the theater. Moonlight folks hesitantly walked up, and host Jimmy Kimmel blamed Steve Harvey and suggested everyone get statues. Beatty returned to the microphone to explain that he wasn't trying to be funny. He had been given a duplicate envelope and card for actress in a leading role winner, which read Emma Stone, La La Land. Stone had received the award earlier in the night. That was stunning. I got to say, I've never seen anything like that.
Well, the weird part is I was watching the whole broadcast at a friend's house for an Oscar party, and she hated La La Land for whatever reason. I don't know why. She just really hated La La Land. So the minute they called their name, she turned off the TV. And we're like, oh, I guess that's it. She was really upset, really, really upset. But then all of a sudden, we start getting notifications from like Twitter and everything. They're just like, oh, there was a mistake. It wasn't La La Land. It was Moonlight. And I turned to her and I was really upset. I was like, we just missed like a totally big thing in live television history because you can't get over yourself.
Oh, man.
La La Land, which is a great film.
It is a great film. I felt really bad for Warren Beatty. You know what I mean?
Yeah, man.
I felt really bad for him. The best is when you, if you ever go back online and look at that moment, the audience reaction is unbelievable. Like The Rock, like Dwayne Johnson is like, huh? Like his jaw is on the floor. And also hilarious is Gosling's reaction when he's up there. Because he's laughing. He's just like, he's covering his face and he's laughing. Yeah. He's Ryan Gosling, man.
Laughing that same laugh he does when he breaks character.
When he breaks
on SNL,
he laughs more than he does anything else.
Yeah.
Man, that whole sketch where they get abducted by aliens.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
There was a beam of light.
Yeah. Kate McKinnon.
I kind of had a hope that she might get something last night, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
She's won before. She's won a couple. She's got a couple of Emmys under her belt.
I just love her so much.
Oh, she's great. 708 area code says, tried to watch the Emmys, knew almost no one or any programs. Were any winners on regular TV broadcast stations? Most of it was cable. Or streaming. That's just the thing now, man.
Network TV just can't keep up.
I know it's frustrating for a lot of people, and I understand that. I totally understand. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you don't have a lot of the streaming services, like how many people know Fleabag? You know what I mean?
Yeah, unless you're seeking it out on Amazon.
My mom had no idea what it was.
Yeah.
You know? She's like, what channel is that on? I said, it's on Amazon. What? Is it that good? I'm like, yeah.
The place where you order packages?
Yeah, it is, in fact, that good. So, all right, let's break here. We got the news coming up and then more award show stuff. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. What are you hearing?
I'm hearing that cult film actor, famous for his turn in some of Rob Zombie's movies, Sid Haig, has passed away, apparently.
Wow.
Unconfirmed as of right now. Unconfirmed.
We'll try and confirm that. Oh, man. That's too bad. Nice guy. He was at... He went to the Flashback convention several times. And, yeah, very cool guy. We'll keep an eye on that, see what's going on. That's sad. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here until 5. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in just a few minutes because it's a jokey time. And we are talking about some crazy award show stuff that's happened over the years. If you guys want to jump in, the Emmys were last night. What did you think? What did you think of the show? What did you think of the winners, the losers, all that cool stuff? And we've got some more crazy award show stories here. Like, for instance, here's the legendary one. Everybody remembers where they were when they watched the 2009 MTV Video Music Awards. Kanye West is no stranger to controversy. He jumped up on stage and stole the mic from the then 19-year-old Taylor Swift's hands just as she started her acceptance speech for Best Female Video. He reached peak bad. Apparently, he thought his gal pal Beyonce deserved the award for Single Ladies Put a Ring on It more than the country pop singer. Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm going to let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. One of the best videos of all time. He said before returning the mic, he was booed, and President Obama even labeled him a jackass. as for Queen Bee, she invited Swift on stage with her as she accepted Video of the Year award later that night. The beef between West and Swift has played on for years, and both artists made diss tracks, took to social media, apologized, and gave them retracted forgiveness and so on. About this one, host Stephen Colbert invited an unwelcome guest to spice up his opening monologue at the 2017 Emmy Awards. During a joke about making this year's show the most watched Emmy telecast ever, former White House aide Sean Spicer came out as Melissa McCarthy, who was in the audience a few rows away. From Saturday Night Live, Spicer declared, "This is the largest audience to witness the Emmys, period, both in person and around the world." The joke referenced a lie Spicer was complicit to about the attendance numbers of President Donald J. Trump's inauguration in January of that year. Hollywood and fans didn't seem ready to laugh at Spicy. And many, like Kumail Nanjiani, James Corden, Cal Penn, and Seth Rogen tweeted their disgust. So I do remember that. How about this one? In 2001, the LGBT community was up in arms over the homophobic lyrics penned by Eminem for the Marshall Mathers LP. When he was announced as a performer at the 2001 Grammy Awards, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation protested the decision. In response to the backlash, the rapper was paired with the openly gay Elton John for a rendition of Eminem's Stan. Glad picketed outside the arena, but the musicians hugged at the end. Eminem couldn't let it be, though. He flipped the bird at the audience.
Yeah, that sounds like Marshall Mathers
to me. Yeah, it does. However, the two have remained friends, with Eminem even giving John a cheeky wedding gift. Yeah, I remember that being a real big deal, you know, having Elton John out there. Because Eminem was being raked through the coals at that time when that record came out. But yeah, you know, when you got somebody like Elton John on your side, that's a pretty big deal. You know, how about this? Good old John Travolta. John Travolta had one job to do at the 2014 Oscars: introduce Frozen singer actress Idina Menzel's performance of what would become that evening's Best Original Song winner. Instead, he bizarrely welcomed Adele Dazeem to the stage. Most assumed he was inebriated, while some feared he had a stroke. He blamed a frazzled entrance, an unexpected encounter with Goldie Hawn, and a change on the cue cards. Menzel let it go, but not before playfully returning the favor the following year by asking Glam Gazingo to join her on stage, and jokingly added, "It's not like I'm going to follow me. It's going to follow me around for the rest of my life." I totally remember that. Like, what is wrong with Travolta? What did he call her again?
Adele Dazeem.
Adele Dazeem. Adele Dazeem.
I don't know how much more wrong you could get.
That's not even close. It's not even close. And this is on the biggest stage, you know, that you're ever going to be on. This is the Academy Awards. This is the Oscars. You know, millions and millions and millions of people are watching, and you call her Adele Dazeem. I don't even know where that comes from. It was immediately went viral, obviously. It was hilarious. I remember once I was watching, I'm sitting on my couch, I'm like, what did he just say? What? All right, how about this? There is strength in numbers when it comes to this still unfolding scandal. Actress Patrika Darbo's 2018 Daytime Emmy for the Amazon soap opera The Bay was rescinded after the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences found submission errors in her category, as well as a few other categories. First, the Days of Our Lives alum spoke out against the Academy and demanded an outside audit. Shortly after, the four daytime soaps on main networks, The Bold and the Beautiful, Days of Our Lives, General Hospital, and The Young and the Restless, banded behind her and sent her a joint letter demanding changes in the voting and accounting processes and vowing not to participate in future competitions unless the issues were resolved. The chair of the NADIS has requested outside counsel be brought in for an independent look at the practices in question. I do not, never even heard of this before. Did you know this?
Mm-mm.
I don't watch the Daytime Emmy Awards.
Yeah, it's not my first priority.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff on during the daytime that I enjoy. But, I mean, the only soap opera I ever got into was All My Children. There was a period of time where, when I was living with Mr. Scott Oak, and we watched it every day. Every single day. I loved it. And so there was a period of time when I was kind of obsessed with All My Children. It was the only show that I ever really watched on a regular basis. Oh, but we also started watching just because, you know, before All My Children was Days of Our Lives. Was it Days of Our Lives? Yeah, Days of Our Lives. And there was during this time period, this was in the early 90s, early to mid 90s. One of the subplots on Days of Our Lives was that Marlena, one of the characters, Marlena, played by Deirdre. Oh, man, I can't remember her name. Anyway, there was a a plot on it where she was possessed. Like she was possessed by the devil. And so we just had it on one morning before all my children started. We just had it on. And I'm like, wait a second, is she possessed? Is she supposed to be possessed? And so we started watching that now. So we started watching, you know, Possessed Marlena before all my children.
I mean, that's a pretty good storyline to go with.
There was a guy who was on Days of Our Lives forever. He played a priest actually named John Black. One of the worst actors. I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a ham actor. He was a soap opera actor. But we started watching that on and just laughing our butts off. Marlena possessed by the devil before we would watch All My Children. I used to like Dixie. She was my favorite on All My Children. I had kind of a crush on Dixie. I thought she was great. All right, how about this one? Whenever filmmaker Michael Moore goes, controversy usually follows. In 2003, he took to the Oscar stage to accept the Best Documentary statue for his anti-gun film Bowling for Columbine and took the opportunity to get something else off his chest. He said, "We live in fictitious times. We have fictitious election results that elects a fictitious president." He said of then-President George W. Bush, "We live in a time when we have a man sending us to war for fictitious reasons." Surprisingly, Hollywood's generally liberal elite booed and heckled the director. The abnormal reaction may have been the result of a general rallying together against the common enemy vibe, because this was not long after the 9/11 attacks. And I remember that. I think people just had it with Michael Moore at that time. Like, it just, because I'm not a big Michael Moore guy.
He doesn't make it easy to be a fan.
Yeah, I mean, the guy kind of drives me nuts. But yeah, I remember that specifically, watching that on TV and going, man, just shut up, please. So, okay. All right, we're going to take a break. We've got more craziness at award shows. And also, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey jokey time, and that's coming up in just a couple of minutes here.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey 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 time. It's a jokey 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 time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah. What'd I say?
It's a jokey 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 time. It's a jokey 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 time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. How are you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on this Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call up and tell a joke right there. You got that theme. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. So every Monday morning, my dad tells a joke. Let's get him in here. Hey, Dad.
I'm there.
How are you?
Good, good.
How's Ma?
She's doing great.
Good. Awesome. Okay, you got a joke.
Yes, I got a joke. A guy said the town I grew up in was so small, the barbershop quartet had two members.
All right. All right.
That's small. That's small. All right, Dad. Thanks, buddy.
Hi, Nick.
There you go. That's my dad telling a joke.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
Yeah, and he'll do it again next Monday. He tells our jokes here on the show every Monday morning at the same time. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Last night was the Emmys, and we're talking about some award show moments that are kind of unforgettable. We got some texts coming in. Carrie C. says, "Hi, Nick and Tom. I watched the Emmys. I wish they would have given Bob Newhart a standing ovation." They didn't give him a standing O? Huh. 773 area code says, "The daytime Emmys are no longer televised, but it is streamed." 847 area code, "Seth Rogen, who gave us Sauces Party, was offended. Please." 815 area code says, "Nick, it was her daughter, Sammy, that was possessed." No, Marlena was possessed. Yeah, Marlena was possessed. I remember it. One of the dumbest things I've ever seen. We pretty much watched it every day then. So stupid. All right, here's a classic moment from an award show. As the host of the 2015 Miss Universe pageant, Steve Harvey had the privilege of announcing that yet another Miss Columbia would be taking the title. Unfortunately, for Adrena Gutierrez, he was wrong. Harvey returned to the stage to correct his error, and she had to dip down and let the last year's winner take the crown off of her head and transplant it to a stunned, speechless Miss Philippines. Harvey told Jimmy Fallon that for 4 minutes of hell were the result of a lagging teleprompter, misunderstood instructions being whispered into his earpiece. It was the most gut-wrenching walk I've ever had in my life, Steve Harvey said. I was brought up to face whatever there is, so I went out and dealt with it. I totally remember that.
That was a bad look.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't watching it, but I mean, obviously you couldn't get away from it after it happened. I mean, I'm not one to usually watch the Miss Universe pageant. Not usually very near the top of my list and things to watch. All right, how about this one? Given how long ago this next flub happened, it's probably safe to say that most readers won't remember this one. When Will Rogers announced who won Best Director at the 1934 Academy Awards, he vaguely blurted out, "Come on up and get it, Frank." Frank Capra, nominated for Lady for a Day, made his way to the podium. Fortunately for him, the award belonged to another Frank, Frank Lloyd, who directed Cavalcade. When Capra wrote about the mishap in his autobiography, he referred to himself as a big stupido. That's embarrassing. Come up and get it, Frank. Oh, it's got to be me.
Naturally.
I am Frank Capra.
I mean, it is Frank Capra. If anybody's going to be winning awards,
well,
could be Frank Capra.
It's legit for him to think that it was him. How about this? Weeks before the 2000 Academy Awards ceremony, 55 Oscar trophies were lifted from a loading dock in Los Angeles. A few days later, as the company raced to manufacture replacements in time for the movie's biggest night, an unemployed junk scavenger named Willie Fullgear found 52 of them while rummaging through a dumpster behind a Korean town, Food for Less, in Los Angeles. Fullgear was given a $50,000 reward and two tickets to the Oscars. The thieves were caught, admitted to chickening out, and received some of them are still missing. Fun fact, the recovered awards were destroyed because they figured no star would want damaged goods, and later admitted that batch was actually earmarked for the 2001 awards, as their policy was to make figurines a year in advance. I remember that story. I don't remember many of the details, though. How about this? In a case of sensory overload, Dame Helen Mirren, who is known in the industry for her sassiness and potty mouth, was summoned to the stage at the 58th Emmy Awards to pick up her trophy for the lead actress in the miniseries or movie with her portrayal of Queen Elizabeth. How many times has she won an Academy Award for playing, or how many times has she won awards for playing Queens?
Quite a few.
Her career third Emmy, apparently playing staid British royals, has not rubbed off on the actress. She ascended the steep steps from the audience while balancing a shawl around her shoulders. When she got to the microphone, she laughed. "My great triumph is not falling blank over blank as I came up those stairs. If you saw the shoes that I have on, you'd understand." Whether it was her thick accent or her posh aura or the assumption that a woman of her age would not dare swear on live TV, the censors failed to bleep the profanity, and the actually hilarious and adorable moment was blasted out to homes across the United States. I like Helen Mirren.
She's amazing.
What's not to love? She's so cool.
Although I thought it was a weird move to be in the Fast and the Furious movies, but hey, it worked out.
Yeah. They say loose lips sink ships. And there have been certainly plenty of questionable kissing moments over the years, including Britney Spears and Madonna's famous smooch at the 2003 VMAs, or Nicole Kidman bussing her Big Little Lies husband, Alexander Skarsgård, after his win at the 2017 Emmys, as her real-life husband Keith Urban looked on. But the kiss that made the most hairs bristle was the overly long one shared by Angelina Jolie and her date-slash-brother James Haven on the Variety... You're not familiar with this?
No, I think...
Wait.
I know about her and Billy Bob and their weird, like, having vials of blood around each other's necks, but was she involved with her doing weird stuff with her brother?
They were a little overly affectionate at the Oscars. It was a little weird. They were at the Vanity Fair Oscar party red carpet in 2000 with his and hers goth duds, making matters worse. Her speech for winning Best Supporting Actress for Girl Interrupted. She says, "I'm in shock and I'm just so in love with my brother right now." She said a little too emphatically. "He just held me and said he loved me and I know he was happy for me." They simply said that people were turning into something it wasn't. Almost 14 years later, another explanation emerged when her mother's best friend revealed they'd spent the hours before the show with her mother, who had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer and received her treatment that day.
So is that brother, is he John Voight's kid too, or is that a half-brother?
No, it's a half-brother. Yeah.
On the mom's side. Okay.
On the mom's side, yeah. How about this? In 1991, during the height of Poison's popularity, thanks to Every Rose Has Its Thorn and Unskinny Bop, and amidst infighting, alcohol and drug abuse, and sleazy on-the-road sexcapades, feuding lead singer Bret Michaels and guitarist CeCe DeVille found their breaking point at the MTV VMAs. As the musicians walked off stage with Cindy Crawford and Eddie Van Halen, the bandmates broke out into a full-on fist fight, and a rift led DeVille to exiting the band. Flash forward to 2009 in the Tony Awards, Michaels performed his hit Nothing But a Good Time with the cast of Rock of Ages. Unfortunately, at that time, his head smashed into a piece of scenery.
Ooh.
Did you not see that?
No.
The Tony's crew said that he missed his mark, and host Neil Patrick Harris seconded that statement as an onstage joke, saying that Michael gave headbanging a whole new meaning.
Good for you, Neil P.
The singer, who fractured his nose and needed 3 stitches to his lip, clapped back saying that he was never given a mark or told where the set piece was. Yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah. Oh, I totally remember that. He took it, man. I mean, it just went boom. All right, of course, we have some of the you know, wardrobe stories, like Lady Gaga wearing raw meat. The meat dress, and of course Bjork's swan costume.
Classic.
Yeah. So, all right. And then, of course, there are the people that maintain that Jack Palance said the wrong name because nobody believed that Marissa Tomei should have won Best Supporting Actress for My Cousin Vinny, which, of course, is absurd because she's great in it. So, all right. Those are some of your awards shows. Memories here. And we're going to talk with Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV, and he's going to make a special appearance with us tomorrow morning, to talk about the Emmys and get his thoughts on the winners, the losers, and the show itself.